STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Well, hello, my dear friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, alive and lively, back in the chair. Glad to be here and talking with you. Had a couple of weeks off. Doing some early season fishing in northern Wisconsin, which I try to do in the end of May. And my thanks to Brett Kunkel and Tim Barnett, surprise appearance last time around, filling in for me. Brett was on board, but Tim happened to be in the office, our newest addition to our Stand to Reason staff. And so we dragged him in to do an hour with Brett. Apparently they did a great job. And so I thank them both for their contribution, and I'm glad to be back chatting with you a little bit here, ready to take your calls and your comments over the next 3 hours about anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion, and of course, keeping in mind that my position is going to be standing with classical Christianity and classical Christian values, and giving giving you a piece of my mind as you give me a piece of yours. Those are the rules here at Stand to Reason. Let me bring you up to date, though, since some of you are following a bit on Facebook, and I say a bit just simply because I wasn't posting as much as I might have because I was busy vacationing. But this was an interesting 2 weeks because, in part, I hadn't taken this trip in 3 years. And secondly, even before that, I didn't take it with my brother Dave, who I had been taking this trip with in the past. He was unavailable. And so this time we were reunited to take this early spring, in Wisconsin terms, spring fishing, I should say early season, late spring fishing trip in northern Wisconsin. And in fact, the leaves weren't even all out when we were there. So it was kind of still wintry looking and wintry feeling. One night it actually got down below zero and froze the water in a pan outside on the porch. So it was a nice range, even though some of the days were warmer. But we hadn't taken this trip for a while, and usually we meet in Wisconsin. But my own vehicle here in Southern California, I almost said my hometown now, Thousand Oaks, but has 285,000 miles on it. And I figured, well, you know what? This isn't going to last me too much more time here. I put on over 20,000 miles a year. Gosh, if I take it to Wisconsin and just use it for holidays up there for our summer and as a new tow vehicle for the boat, it'll last me the rest of my life. So I got new tires on it, got it squared away, and Dave, my brother, flew to Los Angeles. This is a little more than 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago now. And actually, 3 weeks ago today is when he flew in. Stayed for 2 days, visited with my brother Mark, and then late Thursday night, we drove. Actually, it would be early Friday morning, because I was working all week long to finish up all my responsibilities, including writing a new Solid Ground that will be out in July, and getting all of these things done. And as it turned out, by the time I finished everything, it was almost midnight on that Thursday. Went to bed, got up at 2, got in the car at 2:15, so that's 2 hours of sleep, and we started our cross-country trek to transfer my my older vehicle, my 2002 Tahoe, to Wisconsin. And it runs like a top. It's still doing fabulous at 285,000 miles. But and it served us well as we traveled for almost 40 hours, switching off back and forth until we finally arrived at Wisconsin. When we left at 2:15 in the morning, I was the first driver and drove to daylight, which was right at the Nevada border. My brother took over. I went to sleep, woke up somewhere north of Las Vegas, and when we entered into Nevada, Utah, we got some breakfast and then drove all the way up mid-afternoon. We're in Salt Lake City. Then we headed from there straight east, I think on 80, and to Casper, Wyoming. That's when the sun set. And then he took over, went north for an hour and a half. We picked up the 90, went right through the rest of Wyoming, South Dakota, into Minnesota, and then into northern Wisconsin at Wausau, and then headed up in the last leg to the Minocqua Woodruff area where our place is at. Took us 38 hours, and that was actually pretty good, now you think about it, because it was 2,350 miles. And we had to stop for gas and for food on occasion, but frankly, we didn't eat much. We just kept driving and trying to sleep and saw, boy, a lot of antelope in Wyoming. Man, I've never seen so many antelope. They were everywhere. Saw some deer, saw some turkeys, saw a lot of pheasants in South Dakota, and really tired when we pulled in on Saturday night. So that was a great trip, though. Good to be with my brother for that time, and we made it safely thanks to many of your prayers. I appreciate that. We got there Saturday evening, had a quick bite to eat, turned in because we were dog-tired, slept in Sunday morning, went into town to get some groceries and stuff mid-afternoon, got a phone call from my sister, who lives south of Chicago in Joliet area, and my mom had taken a spill at 85 years old, cracked her neck, was headed to the hospital. So that means Dave and I gathered up our stuff, actually waited overnight to find out the actual condition of things, decided we better go down to Chicago. So we got in the car and drove another 400 miles down to Joliet where my mom was in the hospital. We spent a couple of hours visiting, a few hours visiting her, and then got in the car and drove back. She's all right. She was just shaken up a bit and needed rehab, had a collar on. And then we could start our vacation and our fishing. We actually had the boat squared away that first day, that Sunday, before we got the message. We had picked up the boat from storage and got it rolling and got it started. Turns out there was a gas leak from the filter. Had to replace that. My brother Dave is really clever in those kinds of things. And although gas filters are too complicated, I would have looked at it like an idiot and called 911 or something. He figured out what needed to be done. We went and got the small part for $4 and put it all back together. So that worked out. The boat was running, but we had to go down to Chicago and coming back. Now we had some free time. Now I got to tell you something about vacations, fishing vacations in particular. It's always easy to imagine the best. And for the whole year when you're not fishing and you're working and you're thinking of, gee, I can't wait to get to the North Woods for that great spring fishing where the bass are biting and they're big. And occasionally that's the case. They are cooperative and they tend to be bigger in the spring because it's pre-spawn and the females put on weight and et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't always work out that way. I kept thinking about my trip. In fact, it's one of those strange things. Every day when I was shaving, for some reason, the act of shaving would cause me to think of this particular lake in northern Wisconsin that we've done well at and enjoyed a lot, the Flambeau Flowage. And I'd think about fishing on the Flambeau Flowage. Well, won't it be great? Well, I got on the Flambeau Flowage with one of my buddies from up there. And turns out we got out on the flowage a mile from the launch and ran out of gas, which means we had to turn the boat around and on the trolling motor, chug, 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 a mile back, put the boat back on the trailer about 10 miles away, fill it up with gas, then get back in. We lost 90 minutes, and by the time we got back out on this, what had been a calm, peaceful flowage and great fishing conditions, now it was windy and threatening rain. We did fish for a while, but then it started raining, and let's just put it this way. It was not the way I'd imagined it. And I think of Francis Schaeffer, who used to offer this warning regarding utopian ideals, you know, when you expect everything to be just right. He says, utopian ideals always turn out to be cruel in the end because they can never be fulfilled. And I guess that counts when it comes to fantasizing about perfect fishing days, weeks, trips. So as it turned out, we did have some fishing. We had a lot of bad weather, a lot of cold weather, but we still managed and had fun together. And then towards the end of the second week, it really started to warm up. Thursday was going to be our final fishing day. We got out pretty early to fish the whole day. Sun was out the day before. At this particular lake, we'd connected with some four-pound smallmouth. That was good. We know this lake had them. The weather was looking good. The sun's shining. The water's warming up. The wind is down. Perfect conditions. Got out in the lake, started connecting with the fish, and then we get a phone call. My sister Sue, about my mom back down in Chicago area. She's taken a turn for the worse. They weren't sure what would happen. It looked like she had a stroke. We needed to come back down. That was at noon. We headed for the launch, went back to the cabin, buttoned up the boat for a month, took all the trash out, closed down the cabin, got our clothes together, and within 3 hours after we got the message, we were heading south on 51 to go back to Joliet. Drove all the way down that day and spent the night, then spent the next day with my mom. Friday, drove all the way back again and got in at 2 in the morning. Laid down for 2 hours, 4 or so, got up, headed for the airport, and flew back to L.A. So not exactly a utopian ideal fishing trip, but I got to tell you, it was an adventure. You know, just to drive halfway across the country or two-thirds of the way across the country in 38 hours, boy, that was almost surreal to do that. And then all the two full round trips down south to Chicago, we put on about 4,000 miles in those 2 weeks. And it was great time with my brother and good time meeting with my sisters and my mom, and all of that matters. There'll be another season for fishing. And anyway, in 4 weeks, I'll be going back with my family for a few weeks to have our family vacation. So I'm looking forward to that. We'll get another shot at it. But anyway, there's a summary of my week. By the way, probably the most dramatic time was when my brother landed an aggressive smallmouth bass. He had a lure that had treble hooks on it. Smallmouth are pretty aggressive at the side of the boat. They tend to run away, as it were. And this one took off just as he's trying to land it and embedded that hook deep into his hand, that treble hook. If you go to our Facebook, you can see the pictures there. There's that hook. We have a little trick that we use to get it out. And if you're a fisherman, you probably know the trick. And it's remarkable because you can pop that hook out even below the barb. And it's almost painless, and it just takes a couple of minutes to set up, and it takes a snap to get it out. But I got pictures of the whole thing, and we posted it there, and I think we had about 5,000 people look at those pictures. That was the popular thing. How'd you get that hook out? Of course, then I had to tell what we did, and I posted another link there on my Facebook so people can see how it's done. It's pretty clever. But it's virtually painless, and it gets the job done. And if you're ever stuck with a hook, it's a whole lot better than pushing the hook all the way through and cutting off the barb and then pulling it out. Man, that's a mess. No, this is a simple way. But that was the big drama, getting that all on film. And we had some nice fish and a good fellowship, and it was great to be with my brother and my family. But I'm back. And looking forward to your calls. We have a full bank of them, too. So let me go quickly to break, and then I'll come back and take your calls right here on Stand to Reason.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, Instagram, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org. Click Get Connected at the top of the page.
There's always something new for you on the STR.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the STR.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at STR.org.
Show us Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kochel, your host here, giving you a piece of my mind as I do every week for 3 hours. And the live show is on Tuesday nights from 4 until 7 p.m. So if you'd like to call in and be part of the show, of course, you're welcome to call at that time. The number is 855-243-9975. Got a bunch of friends here that on board, so let's get to them. And Daniel's number one from Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Greg. It's been quite some time since I've talked with you, but I'm glad to be on board. I'm glad to be number one to get the opportunity to talk with you.
All right. That's great. Good to have you back.
Yep. My question regards something you said probably about maybe 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I have a bunch of episodes on my iPad, but I just can't seem to find it. Maybe I deleted it. Mm-hmm. But you were having a dialogue about, actually it was just like you opened a monologue about how you teach your kids, and you were describing three steps in regards to their development. I think it was like the first step was grammatical, and I can't remember the second
one.
Yeah,
they're actually three stages. Developmentally mm-hmm. speaking, in a child's life, and those are grammar, logic, and mm-hmm. rhetoric stage. And so the grammar stage is roughly grammar school. The logic stage is roughly middle school, and the rhetoric stage is roughly high school. And these are three categories that are identified in a trivium classical school method, which is a medieval method of training that I think is wise in the way it approaches the training task in light of the developmental stages of children. So different tasks, different things are accomplished in the different stages. And our daughters actually go to a classical school that follows the trivium approach, and we're thrilled with it. And we think they're learning really well. And of course, this is a Christian school as well. So the Christian worldview is profoundly integrated with everything, as well as scripture. And so the combination of factors have been really, really good for our girls, and we're thrilled with it.
Okay. You just said that you're oldest daughter's in middle school?
Yeah, she's 10 years old, but she's in the logic one, which is the sixth grade.
Okay, so the first was grammatical.
Grammar. This first stage is grammar stage. The second stage is the logic stage, and the third stage is the rhetoric stage. Right.
Okay. Now my concern is with my 7-year-old daughter. I have her right now in a charter school.
Okay.
And I wasn't quite thrilled to put her there. Honestly speaking, I wanted to put her in what's left of my small private Christian school that I went to.
Uh-huh.
They're still around, but it's probably about to go out of business next year because, you know, public or private school costs. And they also
sure.
took up Common Core,
uh-huh.
which is readily available in public school. So if you're going to get the same thing and you got to pay for it, why bother?
Mm-hmm.
So they'll probably go out of business at the end of this semester or maybe
yeah.
next semester.
Are they obliged to teach the Common Core material? Are they?
I believe they are here in New York because I talked to one of my teachers who's still teaching, and they're running Common Core in their school.
Yeah.
So I believe they're obliged. I don't think they had a choice.
Huh. Well, that does
yeah.
create a problem for private schools if you're going to get largely the same kind of education in private schools mandated. as you would in a public school, you can see how, gee, it sounds a little suspicious. Maybe I'm just jaundiced here, but it sounds a little bit suspicious, like trying to squeeze private schools out of business. And I don't know a lot about Common Core. I know it. I don't know anything about it, actually, but I accept that it's very controversial and conservatives are really concerned about it from a number of perspectives. So and if what's happening in a local, say, a constituency, a state, for example, is that you are not, you have private schools that can't teach the way they think is best for the students, but are largely mandated to teach a lot of the same approach that the public school. Boy, that's a tough situation.
It definitely is, and I really don't know too much about Common Core either. Although while I was on hold, I was looking up some information. I've done so in the past before, but a lot of it that I've found is basically partisan. You know, so the conservatives on one side, they disagree with it. The liberals on the other side, they agree with it, and I don't really want to get bogged down.
No, but that itself ought to tell you something. If the liberals agree with it, it means that their point of view is the thing that's advanced most aggressively. If the conservatives disagree with it, it's because their point of view is not captured in the curriculum. Now, when I say point of view, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're teaching Christianity. But let's face it, there is no such thing as a neutral education. Every educator brings to the table a set of understandings about the way the world is that is going to, of necessity, influence the way they communicate their material. And so, in a certain sense, everybody is evangelizing. Everybody gets discipled is another way of looking at it. And I have said in the past, if we are not discipling our children, then someone else is going to disciple them to their ends because everybody's in play here. And so if the Common Core is an approach to education that those who are more liberal in the political spectrum or ethical spectrum are really happy with, doesn't it just stand to reason that it's because it reflects their point of view or their understanding of the way the world is rather than those on the other side of the spectrum? So from my perspective, that's a problem. Because one of the reasons that you have a private school is to be able to avoid being indoctrinated to a worldview that you think is false.
That's right.
So if the government says even private schools have to teach the way we teach or what we teach, and again, I don't know exactly what that entails in this particular case, the Common Core. But once they start doing this, then it leaves very little room for people of conscience to follow the beat of their own drum, so to speak, when it comes to values and worldview and ethics, if the government is mandating, even in private schools, what needs to be taught.
That's true. Now, in the charter school that my daughter's going to, they have certain principles that I can say sort of tilts its hand towards the Christian worldview, although it's not Christian per se.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm reluctant to say I'm satisfied with the school, but for now it's sufficient.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But one of my concerns in seeing firsthand the effects that it's having on my daughter, I believe that part of the problem with Common Core is that it's trying to skip that logic step. It's indirect. Like, for example, they'll try to get my daughter to come up with the answer of whatever question, so maybe reading a passage, something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've seen in general, and it's very difficult to talk about it specifically, but
yeah,
what I've seen in general is that with Common Core, it's just skipping that logic step. And if you're trying to advance a child too early in their age, you know, she's only 7, and you're trying to get into the rhetoric stage, which isn't until you said it was high school, or
right?
Yeah. Until high school, that's going to be a huge problem. You know, you want to make them advance, but you're skipping one critical step.
Yeah.
In
I get your point. Let me add a little bit more content here so this, I think, will make more sense. I think you're onto something here. In the grammar stage, this is where, I mean, I don't know, I'm not entirely sure why they call it grammar, but we're just going to work with the language, okay? In the grammar stage, children do not think well conceptually, okay? They think in terms of particulars. So when you have a kid that's learning to do math who's in the grammar stage, what do they do when they have to add up? What's the first thing they do?
Usually counting the fingers.
They're counting on their fingers. That's right. Because I kind of had an impulse to say to my daughter, hey, don't do that. That's kind of cheating. But it's not. It's reflecting their stage of development. They are thinking in particulars. And so they, I got three fingers here and I got three fingers there. And that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 3 and 3 are 6. That's the way they understand things. They can't conceptualize the mathematics of it all. They just think in terms of particulars, and that's why this age is really great for giving them a whole bunch of particulars. So this is where they memorize things like the times tables, and they memorize things like states, and they memorize dates, and they memorize passages. Kids at this stage memorize very easily, and my daughters memorized long lists of things that they needed to be able to memorize for their class, poetry and Bible verses and lists of kings and lists of events and all kinds of stuff, because that's the stage where they learn that. Now, when they start to grow a little older, more middle school, their ability to conceptualize gets stronger. And so does their ability to see how things fit together in a cohesive whole, all right? So this is where the logic stage comes in, where they start thinking about how thinking works. My 10-year-old just had a test 2 days ago, or late last week, I guess it was, on informal fallacies. What are the fallacious ways that people think? Now, you have to work at a conceptual level that you don't have at the younger age in order to understand why certain ways of thinking don't work, okay? Now, you're still getting particulars. You're still learning information. But what you're learning is you're learning how to learn, how to assess, how to develop, okay? And you're gaining Dorothy Sayers called it, the tools of learning. She wrote an essay called The Lost Tools of Learning, and this is where she talked about this ancient way of studying and how it's so valuable. And so then when you get to the stage of the rhetoric stage is where kids want to argue their views. They have their own point of views. They want to put them forward and argue. That's teenagers, you know. Now, if they haven't been taught the kinds of things that we just described, if they haven't been taught the factual particulars and the way things fit together and how thinking works, when it comes to the stage of expressing themselves, they're only going to be capable of expressing their emotions strongly, not come to solid conclusion based on the facts and right thinking. And so the difference here is all the teenagers want to tell their, you know, want to give their point of view, but those students without that are not trained well, and this I think is characteristic of the public school system, that are skipping the stage that you just described, they're going to blather on about their own point of view, but they're not going to have a good reason for it. They're going to have bad reasons for it. They're going to be expressing their emotions and thinking, as long as I express my emotions genuinely and authentically, then that's all that's required of me. And instead of being sound in their thinking and right in their conclusions, expressing what they feel, that's the goal. And so that's why you get young adults now who can't think. They know what they feel. They'll argue with you until they're blue in the face, but they won't make any sense, to put it most bluntly and maybe most uncharitably. But I think that's characteristically true.
I think so as well. Now, who was the author of The Lost Tools of Learning?
Yeah, Dorothy Sayers, Sayers. And you could just Google that, and you're going to find it. And it's about a 14-page essay. It's really worth reading. Because she wrote this in 1946.
And it's still relevant.
Oh, well, the irony is she was bemoaning the state of public education in 1946.
Wow.
So this is what, 80 years ago or whatever? almost 70 years ago. Okay. And we look back to the good old days of 1946, right? So things have gotten a lot worse since then. But she gives, a great characterization of these categories. And therefore, if these are genuine developmental stages of our children, then we ought to architect our education to meet their developmental stage and equip them to learn how to learn, because learning ought to be a lifelong process. And her point is the trivium approach teaches our young people how to learn, gives them the tools of learning.
Okay, I had wrote that down as well, the trivium approach. So that's also talked about by Dorothy Sayers in this article as well.
Yes, exactly right. She uses a little different terminology for those three stages, a little bit more descriptive terminology, but you'll follow it fine. It's really nicely written. And and there is a lot of information on the internet about the trivium, because there are a lot of schools now developing that are following that pattern. But I'd suggest, to learn more about it, go back to Dorothy Sayers, because she started the movement without even realizing it. She wrote the article, and even in the article she says, probably nobody's going to read my article. Well, it turned out that years later people did take it seriously and developed entire school systems after the trivium model. So it's a liberal arts kind of approach, that is, liberal arts being a focus on language and words and how things fit together and communication and, that kind of thing.
Gotcha. Just one more concern.
Yeah.
In reading the articles from the past and even today, one of the issues that I thought about, and I could see where it may be a problem, but I just wanted your take on it. From the conservative point of view, they have a problem with the Common Core because it's basically a one-size-fits-all approach.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, basically taken for granted that all children everywhere within the states mm-hmm. are at the same level at the same time.
Oh,
always.
Yeah. Right.
Yes. What would be your take on that?
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. I don't know about the Common Core, but when you say that, it's just obvious that all students of the same age are not at the same place.
Of course.
I mentioned my daughter's 10 years old, but she's in sixth grade. So that's advanced for her. She's a December baby, so she got pushed ahead for that and then another year. But when she does math, she drops down a grade because she's strong in the language arts, but she's not so strong in the math. And so what I like about the school is there's an ability to be flexible with her in these classes. Even though she's technically a fifth grader, she's able to traffic with the sixth graders in language arts, which is the bulk of their training, and Latin, because they started Latin in first grade. Latin vocabulary and then Latin grammar in fourth. So this has been a real help to them because Latin is important, not so you could speak Latin and order in Latin, because nobody speaks Latin. It's important because it's an articulated language. It's very detailed, and it really teaches you how to think more carefully about relationships and ideas. And so it's a mind training tool. But back to your original concern, it's one size doesn't fit all in terms of age.
Right.
Kids that are 10 years old can be all over the map in terms of their capabilities, and it's better if an education system can be sensitive to that.
Right. Just curious how that works with your daughter. So most of her classes regarding the English arts and Latin she's with the sixth graders, but yeah, when she goes to math, she takes that with the fifth graders?
Yeah, she's in a her homeroom is a sixth grade homeroom, and that's where most of her with that particular group is where she takes most of her classes. But when it comes to math, if I've got this right, I might be missing a little detail here, but I think she drops down to the fifth grade class and does the math there. So that's my sense of things. My point is there's flexibility. If she's being if she's doing well in one area, they're going to move her up to a place where she's going to be challenged at her level. She's going to get bored if not. But if she's over-challenged, she's going to get frustrated. So there's that sensitivity, and I think that's a good idea.
And the balance, right?
Yeah.
And with the grammar stage for the children, what age range would you say that is?
Was it like five to nine, something like that? 5 to 10?
Okay.
First grade through fifth grade, roughly.
Roughly, okay.
Yeah. Or even, you know, four-year-old, you could count that because kids can learn to read before they start first grade. You know, and they teach it at the school my daughters go to. They start teaching phonics in kindergarten, and then they continue on through a couple years. And my daughter Eva's in second grade, and she's just tracking with her class in her reading capability. You know, but Annabeth was ahead of that, so they kind of bumped her up. So that's the like five to ten roughly. For grammar, and then say, I don't know, 10 to 13, 14 for logic stage, and then 14 to 18 rhetoric. But very roughly, because as we're pointing out, kids may fall on different sides of that age spectrum.
So. All right, great. You've definitely been a help, Greg.
Thank you. Glad to hear that, Dan.
I sort of feel like a stranger because I haven't been listening for... actually, a few months, but I have some podcasts to catch up with. I didn't even know Brett did the one when you were out, so I definitely want to hear about that. And I just came up with a question, but I'll probably leave it for July or something.
Okay, sounds good. Good to talk to you again, Dan.
All right.
All the best.
Same here. Thank you.
Bye-bye now. All right, time for a break, and then we'll come back with more of your calls on Stand to Reason.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, your church, or your youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California. In October, we'll be in Dallas, Texas, and we'll equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
Did you miss it? I mean, did you miss the article or maybe the resource that I mentioned on today's show? It's easy to do, but I've got an answer for you. Every Wednesday on our website, we post links to the guests and the articles and the resources that I talked about on Tuesday's show. So if you're looking for something I mentioned on the show today, just go to str.org. Click on the broadcast link at the bottom of the page. For every show posted on the website, you're going to find a link taking you to a list of the things I talked about so you can find the book or the article that you're looking for. Again, just go to str.org, click on the broadcast link at the bottom of the page. All right, Greg here. Just wanted to bring you up to date on some things I'm doing here in the month of June and early July. Let's see. I don't think this July 2nd date is the right date, Melinda. Anyway, June 13th, I'll be at Calvary Chapel in Petaluma, California. That's just north of the of San Francisco Bay Area, and that's the 13th. On the 14th, Grace Baptist Church in Santa Clarita, California, here in Canyon Country in Southern Cal, in the Los Angeles area. On the 19th, I'll be at Summit Ministries at Biola University. It's their Southern California version of Summit. And the 21st through the 25th, I'll be at Hume Lake Camp at Hume Lake, California. You can contact humelake.org for information there. All of the other events on the on our website at str.org/training/events. You can also find Brett's and Alan's and Tim's Tim Barnett's events on the same page. I'm looking here. It's not July 2nd that I'm at Faith. I think it's the following, maybe 12th. Is it 12th? Okay, July 12th. I'll be at Faith EV Free in Woodruff. That's in the North Woods of Wisconsin, and it'll be my vacation, but I always try to do something with my good friends there at Faith EV Free. Been doing that for 20 years or so. Was at church Sunday before last there, as a matter of fact. That on the 12th of July, and the 26th of July, I'll be at Mariners Church Sunday school class in Newport Beach, California. So some things that if you're in the area, you might want to participate in. Once again, all that information at str.org/training/events. Let's go to Sean, also in the New York City area. Sean, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good, sir.
I am. First, thank you so much for your show. You've been a very big help. One of the things
you're
that
welcome.
Goes on here in New York City is that Jehovah's Witnesses have a very big outreach through the subways.
I think that's their center. Isn't that where their main like international center is, New York City?
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
It's in Brooklyn. But because of the nature of New York City, nobody's home, and you can't get into apartment buildings to knock on doors and, you know, all sorts of things. So they have this very, admirable program from a human standpoint. You know, they have people in all the subway stations, Midtown and Belower, and they stand there with literature. And so one of the things I've done to hone my own tactics and hopefully let the Holy Spirit do some work is to just talk to them.
Good for you.
And your tactics book is a big help, but there are three areas. They're not terribly deep, but there's three areas that I could like use help getting my pencil sharpened because I keep sort of hitting a wall with them.
All right. I'll do my best.
Okay. So the first one is your infamous deity of Christ case closed argument. They keep trying to open it. So in that argument, you use John 1:3,
correct?
And reading from their Bible, it says all things came into existence through him, and apart from him, not even one thing came into existence.
Right.
Which logically, would mean that the word has to be self-existent; otherwise, the statement would be false.
Correct. He's the uncreated. The one identified as the Word is the uncreated Creator.
So the problem I've run into at multiple stations is the fact that that verse doesn't use the word, the Word. It says all things came into existence through him, and they have tried to attach that pronoun to the previous verse, the one was in the beginning with God. So they're saying him is God.
Well, let me just go back to the text itself. I know it pretty much by heart, but I just don't want to stumble at this point. Now, what is the part of the problem here is I can see, just from you explaining it, what they're trying to do. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Okay. Our principle, never read a Bible verse, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is the Gospel of John about?
About the Word.
It's about Jesus. Word. Right.
Yes,
okay. And the Word. Okay. So the first 18 verses of the Gospel of John is kind of a prologue, meaning to describe the Word who became flesh in the person of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So all of this is introductory material describing the person and role of the one called the Word who later becomes flesh, the person of Jesus. Okay? In the beginning was the Word. The focus is there, the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word, okay, however you want to translate it, a God or God. But what is the focus of the first verse? This is about the Word. Okay? He, the Word, was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through. Well, who have we been talking about all this time?
I don't disagree with you at all, but I'm having trouble with getting them to agree with that point.
Of course, I'm not trying to convince you, but what I'm doing is I'm kind of role-playing a little bit. For them, because I'm trying to get them to see, in the way I'm stating this, that this whole passage is explaining the identity and the function and the role of the one called the Word. So it isn't going to deviate here in verse 3 and start talking about God when it means to be talking about the things the Word does. So I'm just going to read the flow again. And of course, any Jehovah's Witness can simply gainsay your point. That is, they can simply deny you your point by saying that isn't what it means. All I can do is appeal, or you and I can do, is appeal to the grammatical flow. The grammatical flow is very straightforward. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He, the Word, was in the beginning with God, and all things came into being through Him, the Word, the same one that is the topic of the entire conversation up to this point. It isn't like in verse 3, all of a sudden, God becomes the focus, but rather the Word continues to be the focus. In Him, the Word was life, and the life was the light of men. That light shines in the darkness. The darkness, okay.
I'm not even sure they're going to test accept that Him as being the Word in that verse either.
Okay, but let's just, as you follow it through, though, look at here. And the light, so let's just read, let's just take it as their interpretation for the moment, the way they're taking it. All things came into being. I'm going to start from the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through God. And apart from God, nothing came into being that has come into being. In God was life, and the life was the light of the men. The light, God's light, shines in the darkness. There came a man sent from God, whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify about the light, which was God, so that all might believe through God. He, John, was not the light, which was God, but he, John, came to testify about the light. There is a true light which, coming into the world, enlightens every man. Wait a minute. Verse 9. There is the true light, which light, on their interpretation, would be God, which, coming into the world... God is coming into the world. He, God, was in the world. The world was made through Him, God, and the world did not know Him. He, God, came to His own, God's own, and those who were His own did not, but as many as received. In other words, on their view, everything that follows verse 2 is not talking about the Word at all, because it's all the same pronoun being used. Mm-hmm. If they're going to be consistent, then they have to keep putting God, because there's the same kind of reference. This introduction to the gospel, to the life of Jesus, there's only two lines that says anything about Jesus or the Word, and all the rest of this is about God. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, in verse 14, John changes the subject again and starts talking about the Word again. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. I guess what I'm trying to show is how ludicrous that is in light of the flow of thought of the text. If we are going to take all things came into being through Him, that pronoun to be referring to God and not to the Word...
I'm on your side, but I don't know that I can see this as ludicrous, because from their point of view, what's wrong with saying at the beginning there was God and the Word and they were together, and talk a little bit about what God did, and then go on to say, so the Word became flesh?
There's nothing wrong with doing that, but the question is really, what is John himself doing? Doing that? And I think the answer is what John is doing is he's introducing us to the Word, the one who became flesh in verse 14. And all of this, and I can't even tell you if there's any insight in the Greek that helps us, but just from the English.
Oh, I agree completely from the English. I've tried to sort of manufacture another story of paragraphs or of sentences where I could show that pronoun really should be referring to the Word, the subject of the previous verses. Mm-hmm. But it gets kind of sloppy, and it's it's hard for them to digest because they're already on the defensive.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay. Like I said, they could gainsay anything.
Yeah, I know.
I actually have never, this is the first time that I've ever heard this particular pushback on the argument that you're using, that I've written about, called the Deity of Christ case closed, that what they're going to do is say that the hymn in verse 3 is not the same hymn that they've been talking about. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. He, the Word, was in the beginning with God, and all things came into being through Him, the Word.
I think you have something in verse 9, though, I give some thought to, because if we give, for identifying God as the light, which they sort of have to admit, we have the light saying the light's coming into the world.
So that means God is coming into the world, right?
Yeah, but later it's the Word's becoming flesh. So there is a slight distinction. I don't know if it's terribly clear, but I think it's another piece to the argument.
Mm-hmm. He was in the world. The world was made through Him. The world did not know Him. So this is all has to be God that they think John is referring to. God came to His own, and those who were His own did not receive Him, but as many as received God, to them He gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believe on God's name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. So, you know, this is, it strikes me as odd, because we are talking about believing. The Gospel of John is the gospel of belief, and the belief is the belief in Jesus. And we can see that clearly in John 20, the very couple verses. The whole point was belief in Jesus. So it makes sense, since John ends with belief in Jesus, that when it talks about believing here in verse in verse 12, he's referring to the same Jesus, the same one that we are to believe in at the end of the book. So it's bookended in that way with these concepts. All of this fits perfectly with the idea that the Word is being described here.
Yeah, maybe next time I start the conversation with verse 20, or chapter 20, about what the book's about, and then go into the front.
Yeah, that's good. And look, sometimes it's a little tricky to try to figure out how to work around what I think turn out to be intellectually dishonest ways of approaching the text. Okay, they have a theology that they are deeply committed to, and they will even change the words of the text in order to fit their theology. This isn't our only verse, obviously. There are many other verses that we can use to make our case about the deity of Christ.
Because they changed most of them.
But, I mean, even that Jesus was worshipped, and there's no question about that.
They'll say that it's just giving obeisance.
Except for in the places. Look, at the word proskuneo could mean either giving obeisance, bowing down, or it could mean worship, because it's used as worship in a number of different cases. And I actually did a piece that you can find on the internet, Was Jesus Worshipped? And I did this piece specifically because I was dealing with Jehovah's Witnesses, one in particular many years ago on the show, who was taking me to task on this. So I went through the text. Proskuneo does mean, it means to bow down. It also means to worship. In many places, even in their own Bible, it's translated it worshipped. In the book of Revelation, when John falls down before the angel says, don't do that, worship God alone. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the word could mean either thing. What you have to do is look at the context to see what is being said there. And in the case, for example, when Jesus calms the storm, they said, what manner of man is this that even the forces of nature respond to him? And then it says, there are a couple different references in the Gospels, and I'm not sure which one has this exact wording, but then it says they fell down and proskuneoed. Now, if proskuneo means to fall down or worship, but the text itself says they fell down and then proskuneoed, proskuneo can't mean simply showing obeisance in the sense of bowing down because they already are bowing down.
Okay, yeah.
They're already down. What are they down doing? They are down, in this case, doing not obeisance but worship, which is why it's properly translated worship in that passage.
Yeah.
So if we're going to be fair with the text, we can see the distinction in some of the cases where sometimes proskuneo just simply means to give the nod to, you know, to bow and to, you know, and show respect and obeisance in a certain sense, and worship, because clearly it's being used in both cases, regardless even if Jesus is involved. We can find these other passages where worship is in view. So you can't just, they can't just simply dismiss proskuneo, oh, that just means obeisance. No, it doesn't. It often means worship. So how do we know what it means in this passage? The context is what tells us the story. But
good stuff.
Yeah, and there's a lot more, you know, there's a whole series of things in the New Testament. Let me back up. There's a whole series of things in the Old Testament, characteristics, prerogatives identified of God. Every knee shall bow and every tongue will confess Yahweh is Lord, that he is the rock, that he is the only source of salvation, that he is the light and there's none other, etc., etc. And then these same phrases and characteristics are applied to Jesus in the New Testament, even the same verses, say in Philippians chapter 2.
Yeah. One of the things with this situation is in having to approach them as opposed to them coming to your home and being able to sit and have some papers or whatever to reference. I've noticed in contrast to a Muslim group who had a tent set up by Central Park, and I just sat down and I waited for them to approach me.
Uh-huh.
And because they approached me, I was able to let them think they were in the driver's seat,
uh-huh.
keep questions going. In the end, I had 4, 5, 6 people coming around to keep uh-huh. trying to deal with what I was throwing at them.
Yeah, well, that's clever. So that changes the dynamic, and you're suggesting sometime maybe you can engineer them coming to you as a more efficient.
That's the trick. If you're going up to them, I've really been struggling. It's like a guy meeting a girl and having the perfect opening line.
Yeah.
Because the conversation's easy in many respects, because they're find people to talk to,
mm-hmm.
but if you don't open right, they're defensive, and to try and go as deep as you're just recently mm-hmm. were describing, they're not going to do it.
Uh-huh.
They shut down on you the minute they sense that you're there to proselytize to them.
This is where the Columbo style comes in, where you're kind of appearing as the harmless one, the bystander in this case. They come to you to proselytize you. You've got some, in a certain sense, things up your sleeve. You have some ways of responding they don't anticipate, and so that puts you at an advantage. That's great thinking. Good for you. Got to run now. Sean, thanks so much for your call, and keep up the good work. Give us a report back on how this works for you. I know you had a couple other questions. Maybe next time around we can talk about that. That's it for this hour. Thanks for joining me for this hour. Just a reminder, 2 more ahead of us, so stay with us, please, on Stand to Reason. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. And every single August for the last 6 or 7 years, I've had a lot of fun in Charlotte, North Carolina with Frank Turek and his team at Cross-Examined Training. This is training that we've been involved with giving Christian leaders in their local communities, people who have been kind of connected in some way with their local communities, being involved in the task of apologetics, taking initiative, and then thinking, gee, I wish I could get more guidance, more training, more teaching, more help in public speaking and presenting. And so Frank has put this together for that group of people. Now, every year, of course, I tell you about this. I encourage you to sign up. It's a 3 or 4 day event. The details you can find at crossexamined.org. August 13th through 15th, 13th, 14th, 15th. So 3 full days near Charlotte, North Carolina. Frank Turek, Richard Howe, Brett Kunkel, J. Warner Wallace, myself. We are all part of the team that are training students to be more effective communicators of apologetics ideas, and hopefully going back to their local community, to their local church, maybe their local university, and then beginning to step out, giving more talks as a result of their training and making a greater difference for Christ. So this time of year, I'm always encouraging you to consider that. There's a cost involved. There's some studying and prep you've got to do. You've got to get transportation to Charlotte, but you're going to have a great opportunity to hear valuable presentations that will give you content for your own talks, and then also prepare a presentation that you give before one of the instructors and then get critiqued. And then you can come back the next day and give another presentation and get critiqued by another instructor so that you can be trained to be more effective communicating the truth of the gospel, especially incorporating apologetics. Now, what I want to do for you next is I want to talk with Ryan Moore. Ryan is a college student now at Tennessee Tech University, and he actually attended CIA in 2013 and 2014, so he's a CIA alum. And I want to get some feedback from Ryan about his experience and what he's doing now to give you an idea a little bit of the kind of thing that you might be able to do with the Cross-Examine Instructor Academy training this year. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Yeah, Melinda showed me a picture and I recognized you immediately. 2013 and 2014 were your years, and I hear you're coming back again this year.
Yes, yes.
Well, you're a glutton for punishment, huh?
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about how CIA has helped you to do the kind of things you're doing now, making a case for Christianity in a little bit more of a public forum.
Right. Yeah, I think probably the main way that it's helped me is learning to effectively communicate Christian ideas. I think that it's really easy to pick up a lot of books and read them and to fill your head with knowledge, mm-hmm. but it's another thing to know how to effectively articulate them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that that is stressed highly at CIA, and also in a presentation format. I know last year one thing I really, really, really enjoyed was going to your talks, Greg, and how you would take the time and what your thought process was in writing your presentation,
mm-hmm.
And how you have to be very strategic even in that format.
Mm-hmm.
So those are just two of the ways that's really helped me.
Well, that's great. What were you doing as a Christian worker before you went to CIA, and then what have you been doing since then? I'm kind of getting an idea of how you transitioned into something new as a result of your CIA training.
Right. Yeah. So before I went to CIA, actually, I went right after I got out of high school. So when I was in high school, I started a Bible study that grew pretty quickly. We had a little over 100 students
Wow.
every week. And so I was teaching that Bible study. I was going around churches and preaching
mm-hmm.
For youth services and things like that. But it was all I would just tell people, you have to accept it on blind faith, and you just have to have faith until
mm-hmm.
one day I was teaching a Bible study actually on the resurrection, and a kid poked his head in the door and said that the Bible's a fiction story. And I didn't know how to respond to that, and I wanted to talk to him, but I just didn't know how to respond. So that's really when my mind was really bent towards apologetics. And since then, I've read a ton of books, and I went to CIA, and I learned. And then ever since, I've been really sure to incorporate apologetics into my sermons. I've been able to preach it. A little over 100 churches in the Tennessee area,
wow.
And so I always put some form of apologetics in my sermons. Uh-huh. I've been able to do a lot of just apologetics events in the Tennessee area as well. And now I'm the Roscoe Christi president at Tennessee Tech,
wow.
And I teach there every Monday night over some apologetics ideas. So. A lot of doors have been opened up for me, and a big part of that is because of CIA.
Uh-huh. What do you think, you mentioned the CIA, what you appreciate most about it is just, it sounded kind of like the skill or the mechanics of being a better, more efficient communicator. Has that made a big difference when you went back after being at CIA? Did you feel like you had, in a sense, more tools or more confidence to do what you had been doing, but not quite as well?
Yes, I think so. There was often times I knew kind of in my mind how this should sound, but when I would present it, it would never really come out that way.
Uh-huh.
And even after reading like apologetics books, and then I would go and try to talk to someone who was struggling with the truth claims of Christianity,
mm-hmm.
I could never really articulate it a good way. And you guys were there to answer questions on how to articulate things and how to answer questions. And so I think just being around you all for a couple days and you guys putting all of your attention on us and wanting to disciple us those couple days has helped me a ton.
Well, you know, what I really like about the time there, Ryan, is the a sort of immersion that we have with the students. It isn't like, you know, we're up on the dais up there, and you guys are down there taking notes. But it's really we're in a close-knit group where there's a lot of interchange. When Frank is speaking, I can toss in my two cents, and Brett and Jay Warner, whatever. And so there's this really familial aspect where we're all having meals together. We're able to get close to each other and connect and encourage each other. That's one thing that I've really liked about CIA.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Not only that, it's built my network tremendously in the apologetic community, to where I've met several people there who are really involved in their communities as well,
mm-hmm.
And are speaking a lot of different places. And I can call them up at any time and talk to them about any issue or any question that I have. And if I know they specialize in a certain area. So, like one person, for example, the past 2 years, Alan Hainline has went,
mm-hmm.
and I've got to know Alan, and he specializes in the fine-tuning argument, and mm-hmm. he's really knowledgeable in that area. So I can call him up at any time, and he can try to put things onto my level or help explain how I could explain them better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. I think that it you guys are there being real with us, eating meals with us. And then also, it just builds your network of people who have your back and want to talk about these things any time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Are you thinking, what are you thinking you're going to get out of the third time through? I mean, this is a three-peat for you. It's like trifecta here. So,
yeah.
Do you have a different goal for the third time around?
Yeah, I think I just want to keep improving and kind of critiquing myself and improving my own presentation skills and my knowledge. I think as a Christian, I'm obligated to be a lifetime learner.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way I have all this figured out. I know I'm not the best public speaker, and I know that I can just keep learning. And there are very few places that that I've learned in that short amount of time than at CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I love is that STR and Cross-Examined are two of the ministries that I follow all the time,
mm.
and apologetics ministries that I follow all the time. And a few things have helped my faith more than learning to love God with all of my mind. So it's really cool being around you guys and just learning from you all. So I just want to keep learning. That's my goal. So
well, good for you. We're talking with Ryan Moore, an alum, a two-time alum. Will be after this summer a three-time alum from the Cross Examine Instructors Academy, which, by the way, just for clarification, is not a speakers bureau. I mean, you as a speaker, Ryan, are generating your own contacts in your own community. This was something you were doing a bit before, and now you continue to do it now with a little bit more expertise in your craft.
Right.
But our goal is to help give you the kind of tools and the connections with, as you pointed out, other colleagues that can you can network with, so that you're in a better position to offer something valuable to a local community, kind of a boots on the ground kind of thing. And you have since taken up with Ratio Christi. How long have you been at that role at Tennessee Tech?
I started the club last year, so got it off the ground, and we have about 30, 35 students coming every week.
Well, that's great. Well, super for that. I'm glad to hear what you're doing. This is Cross Examine Instructors Academy. It's going to be held this year, August 13th through 15th, right near Charlotte, North Carolina. You fly into Charlotte, and then there are costs involved, and there are work that you have to do in advance, but I don't think you're going to find anything like this anywhere right now, where you can get apologetics content and you can get public speaking training, and then you can actually work it out with instructors that critique you to help you to do better. Ryan's taken advantage of this, and we hope you will as well. You can go to crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined, like ED.org. All of the information is there. The deadline to apply is July 1st, so you've got a few weeks here now to think it through and to plan for it coming up August 13th through 15th. Listen, Ryan, thank you for spending some time with me this evening and chatting with us a little bit about your experience with Cross-Examine. It's great to have you on board.
Yes, thanks so much for having me on today.
You're welcome, and I look forward to seeing you in August at CIA.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks again, Ryan.
Yes, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Cross-Examined. .org. A deadline to apply again July 1st, and I highly recommend it. I have a great time every year. It can be a little bit challenging at first when you think about it. You got to stand in front of somebody and give a presentation and get critiqued. But look, at what better place to do it than with friendlies who know a little bit about how to do this thing and can give you the feedback, so that when you get in front of another group of people, you're going to be more capable of doing a credible job. That's the whole goal. That's the whole goal of Cross-Examined Instructors Academy, August 13th through 15th. Let's take a quick break here, out early and then back. I got a whole bank of calls. Looking forward to talking with you on Stand to Reason.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, Access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free. So download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's mentoring letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. Actually, I was corrected once for addressing an audience of Christians as ladies and gentlemen. It's kind of a secular way of doing it. The person said, you should be saying brothers and sisters. But now I realize that my audience here is a mixed group, which is fabulous. I'm thrilled about that. Not everybody is a brother or sister in Christ. At some, maybe I could say not everyone is a lady or a gentleman. But in any event, all of you, we're glad that you're all listening, whatever your status may be. Let's see. Next in line here is that I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce this right. It looks like I'm supposed to be Deborn Washington. John, did I get that right?
It's actually Duval, Washington.
Duval.
Duval with a V. Like the actor.
Duval. Okay,
yeah,
got it.
All right.
The town isn't so important as the person. So, John, I got the John part right.
Thank you.
All right. Nice to have you, John.
Yeah, it's only three letters, so, it should be pretty easy.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Perfect. Okay. My friend and I are having a bit of a philosophical discussion, and I was hoping you could weigh in to see if my logic is sound.
All right.
I was following a friend's post on Facebook regarding the topic of color, and he posted a picture of kind of a wide spectrum of color that blended together in sort of a gradient kind of fashion. And the question was asked, how many colors do you see? And there were various answers to the question, but one comment kind of stood out to me is kind of interesting. And one gentleman responds, he says, technically, color doesn't exist. Nothing exists. It's just synapses in my brain interpreting light entering my eyes. And when I read that, I remembered a couple years ago, if I remember correctly, there was a podcast where you attempted to prove that color is not only physical but immaterial.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, the point I was making about color there is it's not a wavelength of light, and this is fairly easy to demonstrate.
Hello?
Can you hear me? I'm still here, John. John. Not sure what's happening here.
That's just shaking. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah. Did you hit the mute button?
No, I don't know what's going on. That's really
okay,
weird.
Okay, I haven't touched anything, so
all
right. I was making the case that color cannot be reduced to a wavelength of light.
Okay.
And in fact, color itself is not physical.
Okay.
There may be a causal relationship under certain circumstances to physical things and our perception of light, no question there. But color itself is not something physical. Now, I'll go over the reasons in just a second, but I want you to think about what the person just said. The way you characterized it to me was something to the effect of color doesn't exist.
Correct.
They are only synapses
in the brain
that are,
yep.
I don't know what interpreting even means here. Okay,
yep.
That's a very vague word. But let's just say there are synapses in the brain. There are physical events going on in the brain that this person is calling color. Okay, now what's so odd about this statement is it's so radically counterintuitive that it's almost like a person saying when he sticks you with the pin and you go ouch. And he says, well, why did you say ouch? I said, because I felt some pain. And he says, you did not feel pain. You felt pleasure. And you could rightfully say to the person who stuck you with a pin, who says that you're feeling pleasure, not pain, how can you possibly have any sense of what I am now experiencing? Mm-hmm. I am the one who is the expert on my own experience, not you. Okay, that's just as counterintuitive to say you're not feeling pain, you're feeling pleasure, as a person saying colors don't exist. You know why? Because I can see the blasted things. I can see them in front of me. There's a color, there's a color, there's a color. Here's the whole spectrum of colors. Why should I believe this person who says that colors don't exist and the only thing that exists are things that I can't get at in any way, shape, or form synapses firing in certain ways in my brain.
Gotcha. Okay.
So before there was any knowledge of brain events, before neurophysiology was developed, what people were just lost in, well, I want to say an illusion, but the problem with saying an illusion is that you do, even when you're perceiving an illusion, you are perceiving something that is real. It isn't the real thing that you think you're perceiving, but the perception itself is real. So if you're seeing an illusion of yellow, you're still seeing yellow, and it is no less yellow than anything else than this pad of paper in front of me.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so now here I'm trying to first make an appeal to a common sense notion. I know that yellow exists because I can behold it. And I have no reason to believe that what I am beholding in the moment is some brain activity. Because I don't see any brain activity, I see colors. So why should I believe this radically counterintuitive thing? Give me one reason to believe that color isn't colored. Basically saying color is not colored. It's almost a contradiction, okay? So I'm kind of going with the common sense notion, and the fact that there may be, not always, but there may be, in some cases, brain activity that goes along with the perception of colors doesn't mean that colors are the same thing as brain activity, right? Colors are colored. Brain activity is not colored. Therefore, they can't be the same thing. They don't have the same characteristics. Ironically, I was thinking about this in the car driving to work today.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Hold on one sec. I just want to let you know that for some reason my phone's cutting out. I wanted to really quickly, so I told you earlier that I sort of had a response to this, and I was hoping you might be able to comment on that.
Yes.
If my phone can hold up, that
sure.
way if it happens again, I'll just hang up and then
okay.
maybe you can continue. But so anyway, I took this discussion to a separate friend, and it was he and I that were kind of discussing this, and he had something interesting to say. So he said, tell them to look up photons. Photons stimulate the eyes through a physical process that cause a physical thing to happen. Light and color are kind of indistinguishable. What is colorless light? Is it white, black, or gray? Those are colors. Color is a property of light. And then I said, color is also immaterial. Light allows our brains to interpret color. And then my friend says, well, technically both are true. And then I say, isn't color a sensation? And then my friend says, but blue light is blue. The properties of a set of photons include color. And then I said, but like a sound in a forest when a tree falls, you need a mind to interpret color, because all you're left with is a certain vibration or frequency of photons that make up that sound or color. And then my friend says, not really. Not seeing blue light doesn't change the color of the light. And then I said, but what is color without a mind to perceive it? And then my friend responds, knowing something exists doesn't mean it does or does not exist. And then we were kind of going in circles, but then I prevented it by saying, I guess my point is you cannot experience the sensation of sound without ears, nor can you, you cannot experience the sensation of color without eyes or a brain for color and memory. Therefore, whether there can be sound or color apart from a mind is kind of meaningless and irrelevant. So I guess my question is, can you have color or sound without a mind to perceive it?
Yeah, I don't actually think that's the most important question here. I'm not sure where I fall on that particular question, but notice how you put it. You cannot experience the sensation of sound without with ears, and you cannot experience the sensation of color without eyes. I actually think that's false. You don't need ears to hear sound, and you don't need eyes to see color. Think of Beethoven's Fifth.
Mm-hmm.
Did you just hear it?
Did you just hear dot, 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 dot? Yes, I did. If you remember, I also said or a brain. You can't experience the sensation of color without eyes or a brain. And then I said for color in memory, which is kind of what you were alluding to just now.
Well, but that means if that's true, then God can't hear Beethoven's Fifth because he doesn't have a brain.
Okay.
God can't see colors. And so I think that's problematic. But I want to go back to these words. That's why I think that's not the most important discussion.
Okay,
important discussion is the nature of color itself. Mm-hmm. And here I like the way you put this. You use the word experience, the words experience the sensation. Experiencing a sensation is uniquely a first-person capability.
Right.
Only conscious creatures can experience sensations. So whether or not if the tree falls in the woods, does it make any noise? To me, that's an academic question. The noise can only be experienced by sentient creatures, and the experience of whether it's the sound or the color is not a material thing, even though material things may in some cases be involved in causing the experience, okay? So you cannot take color and reduce it to a wavelength of light because it is possible to see color where there is no light.
Mm-hmm.
And you do this in your imagination all the time. I do an exercise and I invite an audience to close their eyes and imagine their mother washing dishes at the sink. And I ask them, what color is her blouse? And they all come up with different answers. But then the real question that matters is where was your mother? Where was that image? Where was it? Now, we know it's real because you saw it. You could describe it and you could even tell me what the color was that you saw. But this image wasn't any place physical. It wasn't in your brain, because if it was in your brain, physically in your brain, you should be able to crack your brain open and, in principle, see a mother with a yellow blouse washing dishes. Of course, that's not going to happen. That
right.
image was somewhere because you saw it. Where it was an immaterial realm that your soul was able to behold.
Mm-hmm.
And in that immaterial realm where there was no light, you were able to see the color red, yellow, white, whatever it happened to be, the color of the mother's blouse in the illustration. So that alone ought to be enough to show somebody that these sensations are not physical. They may be caused by something physical, but the sensation isn't physical. And this is a common mistake. I mean, it's almost universal mistake of physicalists to claim that because the brain is involved with certain activities to cause a result, that the result is identical with the brain that causes it.
Yeah, I've heard materialists say that, you know, well, what is love? Love is nothing more than, you know, a heightened level of serotonin or endorphins or something like
but
that.
It's,
okay.
That's an is of identity, though, that it is this thing. It's identical with this thing. But we know love, and what we know about love has nothing to do with serotonin. Now, it might be that serotonin can produce some sensation, but the serotonin is different from the sensation.
Right.
I don't know how else to put it. If A equals B, then everything true about A is also true about B. If something is true about B that is not true about A, then A and B are not identical. They're different. And colors are colored. Synapses, the chemical reaction that's being discussed there is not colored. I'm not even aware of the chemical reaction. I'm aware of my colors. Therefore, colors are not chemical reactions.
Mm-hmm.
They may be correspond with each other. One may cause the other, but that doesn't mean they're the same. And so the illustration I gave just a moment ago is the illustration I used to make the point that color or sound or any of the five senses, none of the experience of those things is physical. And though it may be caused by something physical, the experience, that is the what they call it, philosophers call it a qualia, the qualitative nature of it, the texture of the experience is always non-physical. The feelings are something that is not reducible to something physical. Something physical may cause the feeling, but the feeling itself is not a physical thing. And so the nature of a color is the way it appears. The nature of a color is not a wavelength of light, something physical. It isn't synapses firing in the brain. The nature, what a color actually is the way it appears. Yellow appears one way, red appears another. The nature of a pain is the way it feels. Same thing with a pleasure. That's why somebody can stick you with a pin and you say, ouch, and they say, no, you weren't feeling pain, you were feeling pleasure. And you say, no, that's ridiculous. I know what pain is. It's a certain type of feeling, and I just felt it.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, though physical states may cause something like a pain, the pain itself is not physical because it doesn't have physical characteristics. It has, in a certain sense, sensual characteristics. That is, a qualia or a way that it appears to our consciousness, a way it feels would be another.
The gun makes a bang, but the bang is not the gun.
That's right. Exactly. And okay, you can go into all kinds of descriptions, physical descriptions of sound waves and everything, and you are, which all might be accurate as to what caused the sensation that you had, and you will never be able to reduce the sensation to that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the sensation just is the way you sense it, even though other physical thing caused it.
Right.
You're on the right track. But what I wouldn't do is get off into this discussion about whether or not there are colors if there's no eyes to see them, or sounds if there are no ears to hear them.
Gotcha. Okay.
That I think is a wild goose chase. What we want to make the case of is that immaterial things actually exist. We behold them all the time. They are the subjects of our sensate experiences. And though physical things may not always, in the case of God, God can feel, it seems to me, and see without at the same time having a brain to do so. And by the way, those who are near-death experiences prove this conclusively, where people have what's called remote viewing, where they leave their bodies, and this is very well documented, they leave their bodies and their souls go to another location and view things happening that when the soul returns to the body, the person can't explain to somebody else what took place, and it can be tested, checked out as a veridical experience.
Remote viewing. I will check that out. That's interesting.
Remote viewing. Very well documented, by the way, and as part of NDEs, near-death experiences. And a book you might want to check out is Beyond Death. Is that it, Melinda? J.P. Moreland and Gary Habermas. Gary Habermas wrote the chapters on NDEs, and he talks about remote viewing. So if your friend is right, remote viewing is impossible, even in principle, but it happens. Therefore, your friend's mistaken about the nature of sensation.
Gotcha.
All righty.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate your help.
Pleasure talking to you, John. Appreciate your call. Thanks so much. We need to go to break, right? Yeah, let's do that, and then we'll come back with Matthew and Ryan and Jason and maybe you on Stand to Reason.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, Instagram, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org. Click Get Connected at the top of the page.
There's always something new for you on the STR.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the STR.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at STR.org.
The show is Stand to Reason. That means I'm committed to clearing up mental smog, and I meet with you guys every week live on Tuesday nights, L.A. time, from 3 until 7, and that's the time to call in if you'd like to be part of the show and give me a piece of your mind. Our number is 855-243-9975. If you're outside of the U.S., you can dial direct to our local area code, which is 562. And the number is 424-8229. You have to use the international code, which is, 001, I think, for the states. And you'll be able to get through. Let's see. Some things coming up here in the next few weeks that I'll be involved with, and you might want to stop by if you're in the area. In Petaluma, California, on the 13th of June, a week and a half from now, I'll be at the Calvary Chapel there, and that's in the San Francisco Bay Area. On the 14th, the very next day, that would be Saturday. On Sunday, I'll be here in Los Angeles in Canyon Country, I guess is what they call it, Grace Baptist Church in Santa Clarita, California. On the 19th, I'll be at Summit Ministries at Biola University, La Mirada. And then the 21st to the 25th, I'll be at Hume Lake. And information for that is humelake.org if you want to be part of that. I guess I'm the evening speaker there each night, something like that. Glad to be part of that. Faith Evie Free Church in Woodruff, Wisconsin on July 12th. That's on my vacation, but I'll be up there enjoying some time with my family. I always like to teach there at the Faith Evie Free Church and at Mariners Church Sunday School Class, Newport Beach, California on the 26th of July. All of these you can find at str.org/training/events, and you can find Brett's and Alan's and Tim Barnett's schedule right there on the same page. Okay, that brings you up to snuff with things. Let's go to Bozeman, Montana, and Matthew. Hello, Matt.
Hey, how's it going, Greg?
I'm doing fine. I was kind of roughly in your neck of the woods, so I think I was in Wyoming, not Montana. 2 weeks ago, drove through there, so pretty country up there. I bet you have pronghorn antelope up there in Montana. Is that right?
Yeah,
they were everywhere. I couldn't believe, like, herds of them. I never seen so many.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah. So what's on your mind, Matt?
Well, my question is when should somebody sever a relationship with a family member? The reason for my question is I have an older brother who's not a Christian, and he causes a lot of problems within the family. And does more harm than good. Mm-hmm. He's very disrespectful towards my parents. And for example, last Christmas, my mom had given my oldest niece some Christmas money. And he thought it was unfair to his daughters and actually berated my mom. And my mom was, like, in tears. And
mm-hmm.
I guess I've kind of got to the end of my rope with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a little bit of a difficult thing to respond to. My instinct, on the one hand, and I'm a little bit caught between two sides on this, my instinct on the one hand is to say that you only sever a relationship with the family under the most extreme conditions. When I say most extreme, I don't mean that the person is really unpleasant. I think I mean more extreme than that. Maybe dangerous. Being in their company is dangerous. On the other hand, and this is where I'm kind of, I lean the other side too, and this is what I'm caught between, because I think family is of the most important kind of relationships. They are not easy to honor that, but even so, I think in terms of objective values, that's true. But they are also the most difficult relationships, because the closer you are to people in a familial way, the easier it is for them to get on your nerves. And I noticed this just the last 2 weeks with my brother, who's probably my closest sibling. And we spend a lot of time together, and I'm going to make a joke now. He's probably listening right now, which when he hears this, of course, that will be true. It's kind of like wherever you go, there you are. But even so, and he could acknowledge this too, you know, we kind of rub each other sometimes the wrong way, and that's awkward and painful. We are pretty good about kind of keeping our accounts balanced between each other, but still, you'd like there never to be any awkward moments, but there just is. There are all kinds of dynamics going on. So family members can be the most unpleasant people sometimes to be around, simply, or the most difficult to people to be around when they're unpleasant, because they're so emotionally close to us. Okay, so I'm not exactly sure how to make this decision. I think that if I were in your shoes, I think I can understand coming to a point when you say enough is enough. We're just not going to put up with this abuse. And if this continues, we're just going to choose not to participate. You know, we're not going to have you over or whatever. Now, I'm pausing here now because I'm not exactly sure what to say next. I guess it's time for you to, you know, cut yourself loose from this relationship. I think it's appropriate to address inappropriate behavior, you know, to be able to say to it's your brother, right?
Yes, oldest brother.
Yeah, to your oldest brother, say what you did was wrong. You shouldn't have addressed your mom that way. And regardless of whether you think that she was unfair in the way she distributed her money, by the way, when a person gives money away, is there any obligation, just generally speaking, for a mother to give money to anybody?
No.
No, it's not. It's called a what? When somebody gives you something like that, it's called a?
A gift.
It's a gift, right? So gifts are gifts. You say thank you because it's not obliged. It's not obligatory. Well, if it's a gift then it's not obligatory. A person can do what they want with their own stuff. And if they want to give it all to one person, there is no obligation to give, you know, there is no wrong done somebody else because they didn't get the same gift. Now, human nature being what it is, most families try to be sensitive to people getting hurt feelings about this. And maybe if you're going to give something to one and not the other, you just don't tell other people about it. Sometimes I'll give something to my one daughter that I tell her, don't tell your sister about this. This is just between you and me. Now, I'm not doing anything wrong. I can give what I want to who I want. But I do want to try to spare feelings. But in any event, it's totally inappropriate, it seems to me, for your brother to make a big fuss with your mom because she was generous. And by the way, there's a parable about this. And the parable is Jesus gave, and it's about the landowner who hired different workers at different times of the day, but then paid them all the same at the end of the day, even though some worked longer than others. And you remember that?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, and Jesus said, look, why are you upset because I'm generous to somebody else? Didn't I give you what we agreed on? My generosity to somebody else is my own business. And so I think that's the ethic that governs those kinds of things. So that's why I say I think your brother was out of line for complaining and, based on the way you described it, out of line for the way he complained. So I think it's appropriate to address that and say, you know, you ought not have done that. So, but I don't know in your brother's case whether it's going to make any difference. It sounds like you have a history with him.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think it'll make any difference. Mm-hmm. It'll probably just make him madder than he already is.
Yeah, but. Well, and that's a judgment you're going to have to make. And I do think that there does come a time where a person crosses a line, and then I think it's defensible to say we are not going to subject ourselves to this kind of treatment any longer. But I think maybe this is the best way to put it. I think you ought to go a lot further with family members than you do with other people.
Okay.
Maybe that's the best way to put it, because I do think there's a limit that you can reach. And there's no sense in subjecting you and other family members to abuse. And it would be fair, I think, if the separation that you're taking is going to be dramatic or visible, that is, if you don't invite him to Thanksgiving dinner when he's usually invited, then I think it would be fair to give an indication about why that you're doing that. So if you're not going to invite him, I mean, you might want to say, you know, we're not inviting you this time because it was so hard having you over last time. Now, if you want to reconsider how you conduct yourself with the rest of the family members, we'd be happy to have you because you're family. But at this point, we just don't want to go through that again. I mean, that might be a way to put it. And what you're trying to do, I think, in that case is to say that the distance that you're establishing is a result of his behavior. It's a consequence of his behavior. It's not a punishment. It's a self-protective measure that is the consequence of his behavior. And if he wants to change his behavior, well, then he's welcome to be part of the events. And I don't, you know, somebody might say, well, that is a conditional love. Well, I don't know that it is, but I think there are conditions in relationships of some sort. And you can still love a person and still say, but I'm not going to be with you.
Right.
Because of the way things are at the moment.
Okay.
Does that make sense there?
It does.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough situation, though. And everybody's probably have members of their family that are difficult. And those bonds are strong, and we have to work with those relationships because, you know, family's family, and we didn't choose those relationships. God gave us those after fashion. And,
right.
But I think there is a time when you say, okay, enough. Enough's enough. All right, Matt?
Okay. Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate your call. It's a tough one. Tough issues. Are we over break or no? No, we just keep going. All right, just double checking. We've got Ryan here in the Dominican Republic. Let me find your button. Hey, Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing. You've called before, haven't you?
I have.
Yeah, nice to have you on board again.
Enjoy listening.
Thank you. Are you calling from the DR right now?
Yes, I am.
Man, that is crystal clear.
Wow. It's a great technology, huh?
It is. Okay. Well, good. What's on your mind today, Ryan?
Well, I got a couple of things. Thanks for taking my call. It was interesting to listen to the other Ryan talk a little bit ago. I just got accepted a few weeks ago for the CIA conference, so I'll be attending
great.
For my first time.
Oh, super. Dynamite. Well, we'll see you in August
for
sure.
So I'm very excited about that and doing lots of reading and preparation now for that. And so I'll be going back to the United States in mid-July and then over to North Carolina in August.
Well, you will have probably traveled the furthest. Let's see. DR. I wonder if now I'm thinking about maybe it isn't quite so far because you're just a little south of Florida. Well, you're south of Cuba even at the DR, right?
Yeah, it's actually not bad. A lot of Dominicans ask me, do I live closer to New York or Florida? And I say, well, when I'm in Colorado, it takes me 4 hours to get to Florida. From here, it takes me 2 hours. So you guys live closer to Florida than I do when I'm in the United States.
Okay.
So, yeah, I don't know about that.
Okay. Well, tell me what's on your mind here with speaking with Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, well, it's interesting hearing also the other caller from New York talk about this.
Yeah.
And kind of the question I had was similar. I won your book, Faith Is Not Wishing, by participating in a Twitter contest.
Oh, good.
And really liked the deity of Christ argument and have started using it. And I had some Jehovah's Witnesses. They have a very strong presence here in my town. And so they're always coming by my house. And so I've noticed, kind of like the caller before said, that when they come to you, they're a lot more open to talk and have conversation, especially I've had a couple that's been coming to my house, that was coming to my house about once a week for Bible study, and we would sit down and discuss issues, and it was really good. And I was able to bring up these things and really challenge them to think about it.
Because they thought they were in the driver's seat.
The question I had relates to, what's that?
I said that they thought they were in the driver's seat, so in a certain sense that made them more open to you interacting with them. Does that make sense?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. That's the point that our earlier caller was making. I think it's a great observation.
Yeah, I think so for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So about 2 weeks ago or so, I was at a college ministry event I had, and I was in front of the university, and some Jehovah's Witnesses came by and set up their stuff and started handing out information to students as they were walking across campus. So I was kind of sat there and tried to think, you know, how can I approach them and not come across as, you know, rude or anything like that. So I kind of came up and I used one of the Columbo tactics, kind of the asking a question and being confused. And so I said, you know, there's one thing that's really bothering me.
Oh, you're breaking up there, Ryan. You're breaking up. Go, can you say that again, Ryan? Because you broke up. I just was just applauding your great connection, and now we're losing it.
A better place, really quick.
Okay.
All right. Is this a little bit better?
Maybe. Go ahead again. And you went up to the Jehovah's Witness and you used the Columbo tactic. That's where we lost you. So why don't you pick it up from there? Okay. Uh oh.
Yeah, so when I approached them, I kind of used the tactic of, you know, I'm really confused about this. Maybe you can help clear up the confusion for me.
Yeah.
And they said, sure, absolutely. So I presented the John 1:3 and the deity of Christ argument to them. And they did agree, unlike the other caller, that he or him is Jesus. But the one thing that I had and what I wanted your kind of maybe opinion or advice for is after having a little bit of discussion on that argument and kind of who is Jesus, one of the ladies kind of standing there, I was talking with a guy, she steps in and says, why are you asking all those questions? You seem pretty confident what you believe in. And I thought, well, maybe I'm coming across a little too strong if she's getting very defensive like that.
Yeah.
And so my question to you is, so I backed off, but I kind of was trying to fight for how do I respond to that. You know, they're obviously out here talking to college students because they believe they have the truth and they want to share it.
Yeah.
But yet I'm coming to them and me trying to tell them something, you know, it's like, well, you're confident. Why would you be talking to us?
Yeah, well,
and, you know.
Yeah, here's a thought that I have, and maybe you can leverage that particular issue. So that is, if you ask them the question, and this is just to establish the foundation of your point, you ask them, well, why are you here on campus? Well, we're here on campus because we have a message we think is true, and it matters to get it right here, and that's why we're talking to students. And then you might say, okay, well, that's my view as well. I think this issue really matters. Now, I do disagree with you. I'm open to hear what you have to say, but it seems to me the scriptures teach something different than what you say. And so the reason that I'm here is because I think that I understand this correctly, and getting it right really matters. And so I'm trying to help you just like you're trying to help me. So you and I are doing the same thing, basically, is what you're saying to them. And then
how I responded, what's that?
Go ahead.
Well, how I responded was similar to that without, you know, kind of asking them. And I thought about that after I'd walked away. But I said, you know, I would consider myself as someone who wants to know the truth.
Yeah, that's good.
And if you're speaking something that's different than what I believe, we both can't be right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to hear your opinion about it to see if what you're saying is true, mm-hmm. or if what I have believed in the first place is true.
Yeah.
And that seemed to help a little bit, but I was, you know, kind of wondering, I know Brett Kunkel does some mission trips, you know, to Provo, and
right.
talks with Mormons, and you know, they probably have more techniques as far as approaching someone like that on the street, where
yeah.
maybe they're going to feel more in the defensive than if they're coming to your house.
Yeah, I that's a good observation. And so I wish I had something, in a sense, more helpful than what we've talked about. I think that Jehovah's Witnesses are a tough nut to crack. I think Mormons are too, but it just strikes me that Mormons may be easier to work with than Jehovah's Witnesses. I don't know, but both of them are difficult. And I think what you can do is you can do your best and seek counsel like you did here, and then let the chips lie. You know, whatever. You do the best you can and let the Lord take it from there. And really, that's the case in every situation.
Yeah.
I don't talk to a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses, a few more Mormons, LDS, but not so much JWs. And I have in the past, I've had some conversations, I've written about it, but I just haven't gotten into a lot of them. Some people have a real heart and they spend a lot of time with them, and I'm glad they do. But when push comes to shove, in a sense, you can do the best that you can, communicate the truth in a clear, gracious, as persuasive a way as possible, and then, you know, let the chips fall. I've mentioned this before, and this is my own kind of approach, my own value: speak clearly, speak persuasively, speak graciously, and then let the Lord take over from there, and see what happens. You know, sometimes nothing happens, sometimes incredible things happen, but it's always good to do what you're doing, which is to try to find a better approach under difficult circumstances, but sometimes there's just no magic bullet, is there?
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
But I also, you know, I wanted just to end really quickly. I don't want to take up too much more of your time.
Well, you know, the music's coming up. The music's up, and so I'm just going to have to pull out right now, Ryan.
But okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It.
Yeah, and I'll talk to you another time. We'll look forward to that, okay?
Okay.
Okay, all the best. That's it for this hour, friends. 1 hour ahead on Stand to Reason. Hope you stay with us. I'm Greg Kokel. Hello, dear friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reasons, this show. Glad you're with me. And I'm looking forward to this hour. I usually start out with some commentary, but I've been gone for a couple of weeks. And a lot of folks on the line here wanting to chat, so I've let they've been waiting for a while. I'll just jump right into them and start taking your calls. And let's start with Cypress, California. Jason, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, thanks, Greg. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thanks. What's up?
Awesome.
Good.
Well, hey, I called in, gosh, I want to say almost 2 months ago now. I think it was the first week in April. I spoke to you in regards to trying to get some advice and kind of lead my wife to Christianity. She was raised Catholic.
Uh-huh.
And you gave me a lot of great information. We went over some of the verses that you gave us.
Uh-huh.
I believe it was Ephesians 2, 8 through 9.
Right.
John chapter 1, verse 12, and 1 John chapter 5, 11 through 13.
Right.
And we went through not just the verse himself, but we didn't just read a Bible verse. We read, you know, kind of the whole context of what was going on at
Good.
The time. And she got a lot out of it, and it was actually, it's so funny how God works. It was following Sunday, we were at church, and we didn't have our normal sermon. We actually had a performance from a Christian theatrical group called Eastern Skies.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what it was, but just the performance itself, it just really touched her and spoke to her heart. And I just noticed out of the corner of my eye, her filling out her little blue card, you know, and I didn't bring it up until we got in the car. So I'm like, so what's that all about? And she had mentioned, you know, well, I think I want to get baptized. And
my goodness.
This past Sunday, after, you know, meeting with our pastor several weeks over the past 2 months, she just got baptized.
Well, that is a fabulous, fabulous story. Thank you so much for telling me. And it's your wife, too. I mean, wow, that's really great news. You know, sometimes we have our kind of our left brain and our right brain. You know, we have our affective side and we have our, you know, more thoughtful side. And I think that both are important. Some people resonate a little bit more with one rather than the other, but both are important. And it was like, here you go, and you're offering the truth of the Scripture, and God is using this in your wife's life. And then it is something more on the affective side, maybe more of a right brain kind of thing, that is the thing that kind of pushes her over after you've laid a foundation with the truth of the Scripture. And it's a great kind of a 1-2 punch, I guess you could call it. So I'm really glad to hear that news.
Yeah, it was awesome. And my parents were there to witness it, and her mom as well. Her mom was very supportive.
Huh.
Her father not so much, but that's okay. We sent out the invitation, and he decided to make his own decision. But she was very happy with the family that came and supported her. And, it was very awesome.
That's great. That's fabulous. That's great news.
Yeah. But I wanted to give you that update, but I also had another question for you.
All right.
It's kind of a two-parter, but I guess hopefully it'll be kind of short. So I'm in the process right now. I'm kind of debating with a friend of mine, just kind of give you a little bit of the background. He was not raised Christian. In high school years, he actually became a Christian, and around the time that I had a falling out with the church,
mm-hmm.
so we kind of, you know, it didn't see eye to eye back then. And now, fast forward, I've kind of come back to Christianity in my early 20s, and he's kind of gone the opposite direction.
So you've changed roles.
And we keep switching on each other. We can't be on the same page. And it's kind of funny because I kind of kid him. He's got I forget which verse, but one of the Romans verse tattooed on his arm.
Huh.
And I'm like, that's kind of interesting because it urinates this now.
Yeah, it's like fads fade, but tattoos don't. Even when your convictions change, there they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Well, maybe God will use that in some way. Someday he'll wake up and look at that, and I don't know, and maybe it'll, who knows.
Well, the other arm now, he's got Bad Religion, that punk rock band, lyrics on the other arm. So I don't know. I think he's just conflicted. He's clearly confused.
Yeah.
But anyways, so the question I have for you, are you a young earth creationist or an old earth creationist? And given your stance, how would you defend that against an atheist who believes in evolution?
Well, the age of the universe and evolution kind of there's a very particular kind of relationship to them. That is, if the universe is young, then evolution is false. Okay, if the universe is old, evolution still could be false. Okay, so the age of the even if a person, I believe in an ancient universe. Okay, I'm not a young earther, so to speak. I think the universe is probably the age that the scientists think it is, because I think they think it is for very good reasons, very good empirical reasons, and that would be 17 billion years old, and the Earth maybe 3.5 billion years, and life has been around for maybe 3 billion years or something like that. However, I do not believe the Darwinian project, as commonly conceived, also known as the neo-Darwinian synthesis, a combination of a change brought about by genetic mutation, which change then chosen for or against by natural selection, then is adequate to account for the prodigious diversity of the biological realm. That point of view I just offered, I don't think is scientifically tenable. My rejection then of Darwinism is based on the empirical data, not based on a religious conviction. Now, do I have a religious conviction about God's involvement? Yes, I do. But it is also consistent, I think, with the data, and the Darwinian model is inconsistent with the data. So I am an old earther who believes in divine creation. How that actually took place, I think, is a little harder to construe. Is it the day-age theory, or, you know, how do we understand Genesis 1? In light of that view, that's a little harder. What actually took place? If we were there to eyeball it and witness it, what would we say about it? That, I think, is harder to determine. What isn't hard to determine is whether the results of the process over time is a mindless process that did not have us in mind, a mindless, materialistic, naturalistic process, or whether it's a process that was the result of intelligent design. And the evidence for design is everywhere. And so for that reason, I hold to intelligent design creation, though I'm an old earther. So I don't know what the atheist would object to on that. I mean, how the atheist would object. I agree with him about the age of the universe, because I think the evidence that demonstrates it is good. But when it comes to the particulars of Darwinism, I think it has been considered successful largely because people have presumed it to be the case. Secondly, because people have, and they presume it in the sense that given their naturalistic worldview, there is no other option. And because of competing views that have merit scientifically have been muscled off the playing field. And this is very obvious that this is taking place. And even the evolutionists will acknowledge this. So if there is simply a heads up debate on the merits based on the evidence, I think that Darwinism is going to lose to intelligent design. And that's the way I would comport myself with an atheist. And I wouldn't let the atheist get away with nonsense. Like, well, that's just religion masquerading as science. Right. Because that actually is beside the point. The question isn't whether you want to call what I offer religion and call what they offer science. That actually is philosophically laden. The real question is whose view is best demonstrated by the evidence, regardless of what you choose to call it, science or religion. That's a distractive technique. So I'm not going to let them get away with that kind of distractive technique. Or things like, well, yours is a science stopper, your view, God, or this is God of the gaps. All of this is nonsense. And when I say nonsense, I mean these are challenges that don't go to the point. They're distractions. They are all red herrings.
Right.
So and a lot that's, of times it, in general, the way I'd comport myself with an atheist on this.
Right. And a lot of times it does end up, it comes down to just childish name-calling. Like, do you really believe a big man in the sky created everything? And but I kind of take the role of saying, well, you could say that as my, you can look at that as be my view, but now how is that any less ridiculous than you thinking we popped into existence out of nothing?
Yeah.
I mean, how is that any better?
I don't think, yes, I don't think that the big man in the sky creating everything is in the least ways ridiculous. It sounds a little bit disparaging when they use the phrase big man in the sky, so there is
sure.
a little rhetorical technique there. But why is it ridiculous to suggest that something that looks designed actually is designed? You know, Richard Dawkins, as he opens his famous book, The Blind Watchmaker, starts out by saying, and this is almost an exact quote, this is how he starts his book, probably the most famous book in favor of evolution he's ever written, besides The Origin of Species. And he starts out by saying the biological realm is a complex world that gives the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, the rest of his book is to argue that appearances are deceiving, okay? But look at, if the world appears to be designed for a purpose, even if it's not, if it appears that way, and Dawkins admits that it does appear that way, then why is it ridiculous to draw the conclusion that it has been designed for the purpose? We are working with appearances. Now, it could be wrong that we are designed for a purpose, but saying the big man upstairs did it all seems completely consistent with the prima facie evidence. That is, on the face of it, it appears that somebody's involved. So why would we be called ridiculous for suggesting what the evidence seems prima facie to support? This is just a rhetorical trick to make fun of it so as to make it sound ridiculous when there's nothing ridiculous at all about it. Some people say, well, that's irrational. Oh, okay. If it is irrational, tell me precisely what is irrational about it.
Right.
Where am I being irrational? Where am I drawing a conclusion that is inconsistent with sound reason? And I want them to spell that out for me.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You know, I've been using a lot of the tactics I've been learning, as far as shifting the burden of proof onto him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, asking the right question. The Columbo tactic, one of my favorites.
Great.
So I highly recommend anyone listening out there that has not looked into your tactics, your book, your CDs, anything.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely check it out, because it is a very, very helpful and it's something you can put in your toolbox, you know, and use it when you get in these situations.
Well, I agree with you on that one.
Yeah.
And Columbo is my favorite tactic, too. I use it all the time.
Awesome. Well, Greg, I appreciate it very much.
Okay, Jason, good talking to you, and I appreciate your call.
All right, you have a good one.
All right, all the best. Let's see, 6:30. Let's go to another caller here. We got a lot on. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Let's go to Cypress and... Oh, wait, that was Jason. We just finished with him. Let's go to Ben. Ben in... is that Munsell, Indiana?
Muncie.
Got Indiana. It. Okay. Well, glad to have you on, Ben.
Thanks. Glad to be on. Hey, so I have an ethical question. So I had a guy do some work for me.
Uh-huh.
To cut down a tree in my yard.
Uh-huh.
Paid him up front, and he was going to cut down the tree and grind it.
That was your first mistake. You paid him up front.
Well, yeah, it probably was. But he eventually got to it, but it took a lot of, to the grinding of the stump. He cut down the tree immediately, but then, it just took months, and he was always apologetic anytime I talked to him that he was going to get to it and all that stuff.
Well, what was the reason that for the delay? Did he have did his mother die or something? He went out of town for a month?
I don't know the full reason. Mm. I know part of it was winter, but he had time before winter set in. Then the snow, came, and he couldn't grind it during when it's covered in snow. But
I know
there was a couple of months.
Well, wait, hold on just a minute. If that stump grinder can grind through the stump, I guarantee it can grind through the snow. Just a thought.
Sure.
Just saying. Okay.
Yeah.
But
but my question is, this guy's like a really, I mean, he's a Christian brother.
Mm-hmm.
He's a genuine guy. He's, I mean, super nice. And so I want to just give him the benefit of the doubt. So the work is done. He's finished the work. But my question is, I'm a member of Angie's List, and I'm like, do I have any kind of obligation to, I don't know, because I'm not completely satisfied with mm-hmm. this work.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have any obligation to the community to kind of
So did you find him on Angie's List?
No, I didn't.
Is he a member of Angie's List? Is he promoted there?
No, he's not. No, but you can go on and start, you know, a page for new.
Okay. So like, you'd basically,
I don't know that Angie's List has any tree cutters for Muncie, Indiana right now.
So basically you'd go to Angie's List to say, if you're looking for a tree cutter, don't use this guy because he's slow.
Yeah. It'd be like, you just kind of give positive or negative feedback so that other people can make a good decision.
Yeah.
So I can see like how I can see it from both sides. Like I may have an there's the side of like, well, you know, I'm informing people of the community. Hey, this guy's really great. He will fall through his commitments eventually, but you know, that's the part of the.
I guess so. This is a little bit right. This is kind of a
judgment. Let's let it go.
Right. This is a judgment call here. If it were me, I would probably not go the extra step to put it on Angie's List. That might seem like a little over the top, like a little vindictive or something like that. And he did finish the work. He's slow. That is really frustrating when you want the work done. I understand that. I have a vendor working with me on the foundation of my house. We started in January. Now, there's been a delay, but because I've been out of town a lot, but they thought they pretty much finished the work, and I went under and I lasered everything, and boy, that's really a mess underneath there. So they got to come back and fix it. But I held back $12,000. So these guys, that's their profit, man. These guys are motivated. So just as a simple principle, you never pay for the job up front, even with a Christian, because Christians are human beings, okay? And human nature is human nature. And if they're reliable, they're going to get paid. But this gives you a kind of certain leverage, an appropriate leverage, that you can use to get them to finish the job to your satisfaction. And until it's done to your satisfaction, they don't get everything up front. State of California, you can only you do a down payment for a job, and it's got to be a very modest amount by law, because it's they can't demand any more than like 10% or something to get the ball rolling here, because they want to protect the consumer. And I think there's a good principle there. You put some down to get them going, and then of course this is armchair angling kind of thing, or quarterbacking, because the game's over with and we're looking back now, and hindsight's always 20/20. But for the future, for you and others, even with Christians, you want to give a good faith deposit to get things going, and then as you get halfway done, then you give a little bit more depending on the nature of the job and the cost. But you don't give the final amount until it's all completely buttoned up and the punch list is done and everything's finished to your satisfaction, and you say, okay, this is it, and here it is. And you need to withhold enough for the final payment that motivates them to do the job, to get it done.
Because, I'll definitely learn that lesson.
Yeah. But in this case, I think, look, at the I have had a concern with Christians that they are not, you would like to think that they're a cut above, and that there is more integrity in their work, and they're committed to excellence, and they're reliable in it. But I have found them no more reliable than non-Christians, on balance, and so, given that they're human beings like others, then I think you have to take that into consideration. Now, given that this is all done with, I just let it go personally. And he didn't steal from you. He didn't do you wrong. He just didn't do you really, really good. He delayed, dragged his feet. It might be an opportunity to say to him, let's just call him Bob for the sake of discussion. You know, Bob, I just to be candid with you, I was disappointed in your work. I mean, it's painful for me to have to say this. You did complete the job, but it took you so long that it was a burden to me as a boss or as your client. I don't feel you served me well. And because of that, I don't think you did the best job you could have done in reflecting Christ. If you had gotten in here, gotten the tree out, and then gotten the stump out and got it done with, you would have probably felt better about it. I certainly would have felt better about it, and it would have been a more honorable job before the Lord. Anyway, yeah. You could say, Bob, I'm just passing this on for you. You can do what you want with it. You don't answer to me, but I just thought I wanted to be fair with you and at least tell you that. So when you qualify it that way, the way I just did at the end, I think it makes it easier for people to receive. You don't answer to me. I'm just passing it on. It's all done with. No hard feelings, but look it. And then you give him the opportunity and his own integrity to consider it and to act on it in his own life if he chooses to. But at least, you know, the wounds of a friend kind of thing.
Yeah.
They are better than the kisses of an enemy, or however that proverb goes. All right?
Okay.
Okie doke, Ben. Hope that helps. And time for break. Let's go to break. I'll be back in a moment on Stand to Reason.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, your church, or your youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California. In October, we'll be in Dallas, Texas, and we'll equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to rethinkapologetics.com and register today.
Did you miss it? I mean, did you miss the article or maybe the resource that I mentioned on today's show? It's easy to do, but I've got an answer for you. Every Wednesday on our website, we post links to the guests and the articles and the resources that I talked about on Tuesday's show. So if you're looking for something I mentioned on the show today, just go to str.org, click on the broadcast link at the bottom of the page. For every show posted on the website, you're going to find a link taking you to a list of the things I talked about so you can find the book or the article that you're looking for. Again, just go to str.org, click on the broadcast link at the bottom of the page. And with the show that turns your mind on, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Let's see what we got here. Huntington Beach and Steve. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi, Greg.
Hey there.
Yeah, this is my second time calling. I called a couple of weeks ago about the Supreme Court decision regarding same-sex marriage.
You mean the discussion? They haven't delivered
discussion,
a decision.
Discussion, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You got me nervous there for a moment. I missed something.
No, yeah.
I was out fishing.
So, this is just a comment that I would like to hear your response to regarding the Christian baker who refuses to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding.
Uh-huh.
So isn't this the same sort of situation as the Christian pharmacist who is protected under law, as far as I understand it, in refusing to dispense an abortifacient drug?
Yeah.
Believing that, you know, it's against their conscience and their religious belief.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think in the same way.
Go ahead.
In the same way, you know, the pharmacist can say, hey, I'm not discriminating. You know, I'll fill any prescription you need, but I won't fill this one. But, you know, maybe my coworker will fill it for you, or you can go to this other pharmacy and they will fill it for you.
Right,
but,
yeah, I think
you know, I'm going to refuse to fill this particular one.
Yeah, I think the way you put it is really helpful. They are not discriminating in a general way against the person. They are discriminating regarding the particular medication that they want to receive. And in the same, I think that's a very important distinction. It isn't just, well, you're a homosexual, so I'm not going to serve you. You're pro-abortion, I'm not going to serve you. No, that's not the issue. The issue in the abortifacient is that I don't want to be the one that gives you the medication that can kill your child. okay?
Right.
And I shouldn't. Mm-hmm. You want aspirin? You want Valium? You want whatever it is for your heart medication? I'll give you all that. I don't mind serving you. I do not want to serve this purpose. That's what they're saying. As a point of information, I don't know whether pharmacists are protected in that regard.
I thought this issue came up a number of years ago.
It has come up.
Some pharmacists lost their job, and then after a while, the court, it became protected for them to be able to refuse
at least
not lose their jobs over it.
Yeah, I hope that's the case. Amy Hall will probably be posting something tomorrow in the summary of our show related to that. If you check the blog tomorrow, you'll see some detail there. But I hope that's the case. It ought to be the case, just for the same reason as you're pointing out, that it ought to be the case that a baker should be allowed not to bake for an event that he thinks will compromise his conscience. He is not discriminating against the homosexual. He is discriminating against the event. And for the person who says, well, that's the same thing, then my response is, then you don't know how to make important distinctions. These kinds of issues hinge on refined distinctions that, it strikes me, intellectually mature people ought to be able to make. And when this baker consistently serves birthday cakes to homosexuals but won't do a wedding cake for a same-sex marriage, gee, it looks pretty much to me like he's not discriminating against the homosexual but rather against the service that he disagrees with. And why educated people can't see that distinction is beyond me. Well, actually, it's not beyond me. I understand entirely because they don't want to see it.
Yeah.
What's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine, too. They play by one set of rules for themselves and another set of rules for the rest. They want to win. They are not driven by principle here. Discrimination is wrong. Well, then why are you discriminating against the Boy Scouts by defunding them because of their view about homosexual leadership? Everybody discriminates in this. So it's not that they think discrimination is wrong. They don't think it's wrong. They think certain types of discrimination against them are wrong. They can discriminate as much as they want against other people. So this is about them getting their way. It is not about the principle of discrimination. So I guess I do understand what's going on. But the distinction you made is a valuable one. And I just want to underscore that, Steve. The distinction you make
is
really a good one. Yeah, that the it is a... I'm trying to think of how we put it there. It's not a general discrimination against the individual, because if that were the case, then that pharmacist or that baker would never serve anything to that individual. It is a discrimination regarding the particular issue in question, whether it's abortion or same-sex marriage. And that is a distinction that ought to be honored by the courts. I'm with you on that, Steve.
Yeah, and just extending it a little bit further, I think in one of your other weeks you discussed the example of like a Christian pastor, being, quote unquote, forced to marry administer a same-sex wedding along the same reins.
Yeah.
You could maybe use the same defense.
Okay.
I will take your confession. You're welcome to my church or whatever else, but I'm not going to do, your same-sex wedding.
That's right. And by the way, and I think that pastors also should refuse to do weddings between someone who claims to be a Christian and someone who claims not to be a Christian.
Yeah, I agree with that
as well. It's the same kind of thing, but that isn't, up for a discussion. I mean, it isn't like people are screaming discrimination, but it is a similar situation. To officiate at an inappropriate service, a morally inappropriate service, is wrong, and pastors should be allowed to make that distinction. So,
yeah.
Okay, good job, Steve.
All right, thanks, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate the call. Sorry for cutting you off just then. Let's see, look at the clock. Oh, plenty of time here. In Renton, Washington, Aaron, hello, sir.
Hey, Greg. Hey. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I guess before I ask my question, I just wanted to say that you being gone the last couple weeks has really made me reflect on the value of what I get from SDR, especially the show.
Hmm.
And I'm glad my wife and I upped our monthly contribution to you guys, and I would just encourage anyone listening, if you're getting something from the show or from SDR in general, maybe it's time to consider giving back.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate that. I agree with the idea, too. You should give where you're being fed. That's the principle from Galatians 6, so thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So what's on your mind here, Aaron?
So I guess the question, I think you have the general form of it. The question was a little more specific in terms of more of a hypothetical, and, you know, given the recent events, this is becoming more and more probable that you would have a church that believes the or holds to the biblical view, I would say, of same-sex marriage. And in the foreseeable future, you could end up with a scenario where you have a couple that comes into the church that are either married or non-married, but I guess hypothetically, one of them comes to accept Christ and then decides they want to get baptized.
Mm-hmm.
And what are your thoughts on the church's position? Should they or should they not baptize that person who is in an openly same-sex marriage or relationship? I'd just like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is a little trickier question. Something similar to this came up a lot. But I was going to say during the Jesus movement, because I was familiar with a couple of instances of that, but or especially one in particular. But I guess it comes up now too. You have two people, a male and female, living together, and then they become Christian. Now what? I'm certain there are people that are going to say, well, before they become Christian or when they become Christian, they have to repent of their sin, and their sin is fornication, and so they got to stop doing that. Now, I do think they should stop doing that. I will say for myself that it took me about a year and a half or 2 years into my Christian life before I got that part of my life kind of squared away. Which means I'm living in some ways that are inconsistent. I was living in some ways inconsistent with being a Christian. Well, that's certainly true. I'm a Christian now 42 years, and guess what? I'm still living in ways that are inconsistent with being a Christian. I'm not bragging about that. I'm just saying that I too am a man and a human being, and I press on for the upward calling, kind of not having accomplished yet the status that I ought to be in as a Christian. So in Galatians chapter 2 or 3, Paul is upbraiding the Galatians for their immaturity, their falling backwards from the gospel that he preached into a different kind of gospel. And he upbraids them because he has to speak to them now as carnal or as fleshly or as babes in Christ. Now, when he says that, he's disparaging the Galatians, okay? But what's interesting is it's almost an acknowledgement, though, that those who are young in Christ still are kind of characterized by behavior that is not consistently Christian, okay? I'm looking for the passage here, chapter 3. Maybe it's not chapter 3, maybe it's chapter 2. Oh, heck, I can't find it right now. But he says, I can't come to you as mature Christians, but as to carnal or as to babes in Christ, something to that effect. Now, I think what that is meant to convey is there is a transition time where you become a believer, and then you have all these habits that are not consistent with being a follower of Christ that need to come under adjustment, okay? But that takes a little time. It isn't like, okay, now you're a Christian, now stop sinning. My conviction is that God catches his fish and then he cleans them, okay? Which means that that it is only under the influence of the Holy Spirit living in us that we can have any victory over our fleshly appetites. but we ought to begin having a victory. So then the question becomes a judgment call, and well, how hard do you press on that early on? Do you say, okay, you want to get baptized, you guys are living together? Now, that's not consistent with good Christianity. I'm talking about heterosexual now.
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe you do. And in fact, the case that I'm thinking of, I think that was brought to the person's attention. You know, look, you guys are now followers of Christ, so what are you going to do here? And I think that's good to direct people like that, in that fashion. But I got baptized before I was squared away in the sexual area. I got baptized because now I was choosing to be a follower of Christ, and I was publicly demonstrating that decision. But I still had lots of issues to deal with in my life, and in fact, still do. Not gross immorality like then, but a lot of deep-seated stuff that have to do with self and flesh and ego and trust and all those other things that are a whole lot harder to deal with than immorality. Sexual immorality seems to me harder, at least. So I'm just using that as a parallel now to begin thinking about how we're going to deal with a same-sex married couple, okay, in the church. I guess if I were the pastor, go ahead.
I was going to say, do you think there's a little bit of a difference at all in the sense that if you had a same-sex marriage couple in the church and you baptize one of them publicly in front of the congregation, that would in some way or could be perceived as affirmation of that relationship?
Well, I think that's a concern, but it would also be a concern if you're baptizing a heterosexual couple that are living together. Because if they're still living together, then that would seem like that could be construed as an affirmation. So these are all important things to be taken into consideration. I think under this circumstance, if I was a pastor and there was a heterosexual couple who were living together who now are professing to be Christians and they're coming baptized, I think that would be the point where it would be necessary to say, you know what, well, we've got a problem here. We've got a concern. And the concern is that you're living in a relationship that is not honoring to the God that you're now pledging, or I should put it this way, it's deeply dishonoring to the God that you are now pledging to want to follow. So I think that as a point of consistency, you have a decision to make. And that is, are you going to continue living the way you're living? And I guess under those circumstances, if I were the pastor, I would have a hard time approving the baptism. Or are you going to move out from each other, or in the case that I'm thinking of, they actually got married. They did move out, and then they got married fairly quickly. but they made it right. Now, where the parallel breaks down is that a same-sex couple can't make it right.
Right.
Except by breaking off the relationship that they had. Now, I don't think that, you know, that if they got married in the eyes of the state, I don't think that's a marriage in God's eyes at all. Just because the state gave them a license doesn't mean anything to God. Same-sex marriage is a contradiction in terms, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
As if somebody were saying, well, I married my potted petunia. Well, we're laughing because it sounds ridiculous, but same-sex marriage sounded ridiculous a while back, too. We realize that marriage is not the kind of thing that you have between a human and a plant. And I think it also, by parallel, a marriage is not the kind of thing that happens between two members of the same sex. So I would say it's not a real marriage that is even being honored here. So I guess where I'd land on this is if a same-sex couple was legally married by the state— and they were coming to Christ and they wanted to be baptized, I think I would have to, I need to talk to them about this issue and explain to them that, do they understand that their current relationship is inconsistent with being a follower of Christ? Because 1 Corinthians 6 says that homosexuals, along with fornicators and adulterers, will not inherit the kingdom of God. Now, I don't think he's talking about somebody who has an occasion of that, but people who are living in that pattern. This is their lifestyle. This is what they do.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, that means you're not a Christian.
So, where would you... So you're saying you would talk to them ahead of time, make sure they understand. Where do you end up drawing the line at that then if somebody has... Because, I mean, everyone, when they come to Christ, is still, as you mentioned, they have fleshly tendencies,
yes,
if
of
you
course,
will,
but
sinful tendencies. So where do you draw the line on what issues you talk to them about
very
or don't
good
talk
question.
To them about? And,
yeah, very good question. And my response to that is that I think that there are some sin that is more egregious than other sin and more damaging to the body. And so in the case of adultery that Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 5, Paul was mortified that they were not dealing with this sin in the church. They weren't casting this man out from their congregation. Instead, they were broad-minded about it. And there Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, I'm quickly going to it, Paul says, let's see, your boasting is not good, little leaven leavens the whole, therefore... he says, I wrote to you in a letter not to associate with immoral people. I didn't mean the immoral people of the world, because you'd have to go out of the world. But actually, I wrote to you, now here, not to associate with any so-called brother. In other words, if they're doing the things that he's just about to mention, their own salvation is in question. So-called brother, if he is an immoral person or covetous or an idolater, a reviler, a drunkard, or a swindler, not even to eat with such a one. And the particular issue that he was dealing with was a man was having his father's wife, probably a stepmother, but sexually having her. So there are a number of sins that are particularly egregious and that I think need to be addressed sooner than others. Some sins are worse than others. So this is also going to be a judgment call. Listen, we know if we... made the requirement that you had to get rid of all your sin before you got baptized. Well, nobody would get baptized, right?
Yeah.
But by the same token, and what if a guy's, he's a drug dealer? Well, you can't be a Christian and a drug dealer. Stop that right now. Mm. Well, that's the way I make a living, man. Well, okay, then you got to choose which life of the flesh or life of the spirit. You got to make a choice here. I know it's going to be hard, but so people in idolatry, get rid of the idols, right? So I think that should give some guidance there. In some measure, there's a judgment call, but generally speaking, there are lots of things that are, some things are more egregious than others and need to be addressed more aggressively sooner.
Would that same principle then apply more or less to, say, church membership?
Well, church membership is actually a cultural contrivance. You can be... it's what some churches have developed as a way of formally identifying a person as part of their group. But there's no such thing as church membership in that sense in the New Testament. You are a member of the church if you are a follower of Christ and you are part of a local body. I've actually never signed any membership papers for the church my wife and I go to, but we're considered members there, owners, as our pastor puts it. We've owned this congregation as our own. So there may be other requirements for church memberships, that is formal voting membership in a local body. But that's more political than and organizational than it is biblical. Hey, look, Aaron, I got to run, okay? Because we got a lot of callers.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Yeah, I appreciate,
appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It's good to talk to you. I'm going to skip this break coming up because we got so many people on the line, and I want to get to as many as we can here. Let's go to Andrew in line 4 here. Andrew in Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Greg.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. First time calling, long time listening.
Oh, good. Glad to have you on board.
Great. So I was calling. I'm working on my own apologetic argument, and I tried to come up with a very simple, argument for the rationality of faith, and I was hoping to get some feedback on that.
Okay.
Because you know, a lot of apologetic arguments, they use you know, a lot of big terms, and this one's kind of I can't remember if I developed it like at least right around the time that you're actually friends with Dennis Prager, so you're probably familiar with his Prager University courses.
Sure. Uh-huh.
So Frank Pastore had one called the Four Big Bangs. And
right. I thought that was a superb title. I love the concept of the Four Big Bangs. And if he went no further than just mentioning that, it's a useful concept because there are four dramatic singularities, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of consciousness, and I'm not sure what the fourth one is.
The moral.
The origin of morality. That defy naturalistic explanation. And so that's it's a great. In fact, when I heard about the Four Big Bangs, I thought, Frank, you got that. I wish I would have thought that up before you. But
yeah, and I can't, like, in my own rationalizing of you know, trying to figure out, like, things science couldn't figure out, I came up with the same points pretty much. And I couldn't remember if it was influenced because it was, like, right around the same time, back in, like, the mid-2000s when I first heard it. But I tried to get it down because he uses, like, the cosmological, the anthropomorphic, and so I tried to, like, get it as simple as I could. So I've developed four syllables that kind of sum everything up.
Okay.
So that's stuff, cells, smart, and sin.
What, stuff, what was the second?
Cells.
Cell?
Cells, like a
self. Cells. Okay, yeah. Smart. Okay, there's your S's. And sin?
Smart. And sin, yeah.
Okay.
So it's
stuff,
all
self, smart, and sin. Okay.
Yeah.
Stuff would be cosmological. Self would be consciousness. Is that right?
Right, yeah. And the separation of, you know, humans from every other form of life.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and I just want some feedback if that... I think it conveys the message. Like, I tried to, like, just get it so simple that anyone could just pull it out real quick rather than trying to have to think of any, you know.
Well, let me give you a quick response. Stuff, I like that, but I actually use that concept in a talk on naturalism. I talked about bumping into reality, and the first bump was the bump of stuff. So that's the cosmological argument. So you and I are using the same terminology. I think that's useful.
Okay.
It's not clear to me, though. Stuff was cosmological, but I had to stop and pause, and even knowing these arguments, now would self be consciousness? Okay, smart. What is smart, and what is sin?
Self.
Is sin moral?
No, it was cells, C-E-L-L-S, like the biological cells. So
C-E-L-L-S?
Yeah.
I'm
so
sorry.
Life,
okay,
from
stuff,
so
cells.
You go from stuff to cells.
Yeah.
To smarts.
And
then,
is that smart? Is smart consciousness?
Yeah. Smarts would be, you know, the basically cells developing into a thinking computer.
Yes, okay,
say.
Gotcha. All right. Well, that makes sense now. Here's my if you're thinking about using a tool to help yourself remember these four points, I think you've got a good tool because these terms mean something to you. If you're looking for a tool that will help other people remember, I don't think these four are as good as the Four Big Bangs.
Okay.
I think the Four Big Bangs, the origin of stuff, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of consciousness, and the origin of morality, I think that's a lot easier for me to remember. In fact, I remembered three, and I was pretty sure about the fourth one, even though I was kind of starting from a dead stop when you mentioned it. But the stuff, cells, smart, and sin, that doesn't strike me as easy to remember those four points. But I'm glad you're working on these things. I think it's great that you're working on these, building a mnemonic to help you remember. When I heard Frank Pastore's Four Big Bangs, I thought, okay, well, that's it for me. I can't improve on that. I'm just going to use that. And I wish I thought of it, but, you know, Frank's a pretty smart guy. He's gone. He's with the Lord now, but he's a pretty smart guy. And I actually had a philosophy of mind with Frank and knew him well because we took our master's together under J.P. Moreland.
Okay.
But there you go. So that's my thought. All right, Andrew?
All right.
Okay, keep up
Great.
The good work.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Let's see. That's Andrew in Pennsylvania. Let's go to West Hills, California. And Ron, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Yeah, hi, Greg.
Hi there.
I have a question in regard to, you know, this debate with the young Earth, old Earth.
Uh-huh.
And I tend to agree with you. I'm kind of an old Earth creationist, I guess. But one argument I had heard one time, because, you know, sometimes when you listen to various radio programs and they have people on to represent their views, the question came up about, well, what if, you know, if it appears, for instance, the age of our solar system, which might be 4.5 billion years old, and the age of the universe could be 14 billion years old. If you saw a constellation out there that looks like it's 14 billion years away from us, that's how long it takes the light to travel here, the question came up, well, how could that be if the universe is young?
Yeah.
And the answer given was, well, that's because God can give the appearance of something being old. You know, so he can make the light appear that would have taken 14 billion years to travel if it is out there 14 billion years, so that it, we don't have to wait 14 billion years for it to travel.
Right.
He just makes it appear. And I guess you could say the same thing with the age of things on this planet, you know, whether they can date rocks, how old or fossils or anything else. And what bothered me about that argument was that basically is just saying that, well, God can cause us to can kind of deceive us if he chooses to about things. And, you know, and yet that was an argument they, that was the argument they used to say, even if the galaxy exists 14 billion years from here, the light can be made to appear.
I'm with you on this. I think it does reduce to a deception, but that has to do with the nature of light itself. When you let me back up and put it this way. If Adam was created to appear like a mature man, okay, fair enough. He was, in my view.
Yes.
He was. He appeared mature, but he had memories of his childhood. As any 20, 25, 30-year-old man would have memories of his childhood, if he had memories of a childhood he did not experience, would that be considered deceptive?
And I would think so, yes.
Yeah, I think most people would acknowledge that. Now, think about what light is. A light is not just a glow. If you fly in an airplane at night, come across the desert, as I've done many, many times, to fly into L.A. At 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, you see a distant glow. But as you get closer, that glow articulates itself into particulars. And the particulars are events that are taking place that you cannot see distinctly from a distance. But when you get closer, you can see distinctly events in history that are taking place. What light is an image of events that took place. When we see the starlight, we just see a glow, and I guess one could imagine, well, God could create that glow. But the glow isn't just a generalized glow. What if that glow turns out to be a supernova that looks like, from all our measurements, occurred 20 billion years ago. Oh, no, not 20 billion, 20 million years, let's just say that. And because that's the distance. And then, so then on this view, there was no supernova. There wasn't an explosion of a star 20 million years ago. There wasn't anything 20 million years ago. Instead, this is a light show of an exploding star, which star never existed, which explosion never took place. All you're seeing is the light show that God created in transit. Well, that strikes me as very similar to God creating Adam with memories of his childhood, and that would be a deception. Now, I wrote a piece on this called Starlight in the Age of the Universe. You can find that online. And I go into detail about this because I do think this is a serious problem for young earthers. And there have been some young earthers who have acknowledged that the appearance of age argument is not sound. And one physicist, last name Humphreys, has a different way of characterizing young earth that doesn't run into this problem. But so he's a young earther, but he's with me in saying that these arguments are not good ones for young earthers to use, this appearance of age, because of the difficulty, as I pointed out, that it appears like, and you acknowledge, that it appears like God has been deceiving. And I do think that that charge sticks on their view. So this becomes, I think, a compelling reason not to take the young earth view seriously, because it creates the problem of starlight. And keep in mind, when God spoke to Abraham, he said, "Look up to the stars." So God identifies these things as stars. He was affirming that Abraham was looking at real stars. Now, he wasn't seeing the stars in real time. We don't see anything in real time.
Yes.
We don't see the sun in real time. There's a delay, but nevertheless, it's still the real thing that we see, even though it's delayed. So the same thing with stars. If the young earth view is true, and there are real stars out there a long way out, then the things we see never existed, and the things that do exist, we will never see. That's the things we see, that is the light, are light of things that never actually existed. Those stars didn't exist. What we are seeing, if God created in transit, is not the real thing. It's just the light show. And the things that actually exist are so far out that the light from those events on that actual thing will never reach us in human history. Will be long gone before that, I'm sure. So this is an odd position, I think, for young earthers to have to defend in light of that. So check out Starlight and the Age of the Universe, I guess, is the title. If you just look up the keyword starlight, you'll find the piece, and I go into quite a bit of detail there. Hey, thank you for the call, Ron, and that's it for the show, friends. What a great time I've had with you. Thank you so much for your participation, all right? And use what you've learned today to help give heaven to others, all right? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.